Here we go again.
It's time to talk.
I thought it was April Fool's Day when I heard that one. Get me off the air before I have a heart attack. We will have nothing to see for it. There's been many false dawns.
The Neil Prendeville Show on Red FM.
The kindness of Cork people will never let you down.
Conversation that matters.
Be part of the conversation. Get involved in the Neil Prendeville Show with Mercedes-Benz Cork. Text 0868104106. Paperwise this morning. Hasn't a day gone by now, and certainly on this radio program, that I haven't been talking about deaths on our roads, whether it was cars, vans, trucks, or motorbikes. And the front of this morning's Echo says, completely numbed. That's the local community that's been impacted of late. And God knows there's been more than one. A man in his 40s from North Cork yesterday becoming the third motorcyclist to die on Cork roads within 72 hours. And this is up in Ballydesmond, where the community are left completely numbed and saddened. The death of a man from the locality, lads. He was on a motorbike and involved in a collision with a truck yesterday morning. And the incident took place very near the Cork-Kerry border, because it's where Ballydesmond is. Papers this morning, Owen English goes into a lot more detail then in the Examiner today. It talks about the death of four more people on the roads in the last 4 days. I think the total now is standing at 68 people have died on our roads, 17 more than the same period in 2023. If this trend continues, there's going to be shocking amounts of fatalities on our roads in 2024. Now, motorcyclists, Owen English says this morning, account for 1.5% of all vehicles on the roads. But so far in 2024, bikers have accounted for more than 10% of the deaths. And I see the Irish Road Victims Association are saying that people, and this is a headline in the Examiner, people have lost fear of penalty points. People seem to have lost the fear of penalty points, or being caught speeding or drink driving or losing their license. Would you agree or disagree with that? That they've lost the fear of it. Maybe they feel, well, there's hardly ever any checkpoints. And we hear in the radio news and we see in the newspapers that the amount of checkpoints are down year on year on year. So maybe I have a better chance of getting away with it. But the Irish Road Victims Association is saying we need to treat motoring offences as motoring crimes. We need real sanctions. We need the real risk of losing your license. And we need staff, and we need the staff and the equipment and the Gardaí, and we need more of them. So Ballinahina, of course, also featured in the last couple of days, because we had another death of a young motorcyclist in Ballinahina, a man by the name of Paul Harrington in his mid-20s. He died when he was on his motorbike and was in collision with a van on Tuesday just before 6 p.m. Papers also talk today, of course, about the unlawful killing of 48 victims at the Stardust nightclub in 1981. I'll explain to you just after the break this morning why that number really is 49 and not 48. But the Stardust survivor Antoinette Keegan, who lost her two sisters, has said that she wants the disaster added to the school curriculums so that students can learn how the state failed the families of the blaze for over 40 odd years. And she's saying that the 48 victims' families also want Norma Foley to work with the committee to get that to happen within the Department of Education. Teach Stardust in schools, say the campaigners. And much has been said about the actual tragedy and the loss of all those lives. And over again I've been reading, particularly from commentators in Dublin, that this was a working class area of Dublin. These were working class people. And for that reason, all through the 80s primarily, and then into the 90s and the noughties, because of their working class background, they were treated very differently. Harsh to say, I know, but many believe that to be the case. And then one of the cruelest cases I've seen in quite some time, and God knows we've seen enough of them in the courts, is a court report from Liam Healan. If you don't mind, I might just spend a minute or two on this one in particular, because it's the story of a 60-year-old woman, right? She presented herself using the name of her 77-year-old cousin who had just died. And in she went, and she withdrew everything from the dead woman's credit union account, over €21,900. And yesterday, she got jail for 9 months. Sheila Ahern from Ballyhooly was sentenced to 18 months and got half of it suspended. The judge said she showed utter contempt and disregard for the memory of her late cousin. Fortunately, the judge says, you were foiled, and all but €50 was actually returned out of the all of the money, save €50. The rest of it, of the nearly €22,000. But anyway, the judge acknowledged that she did plead guilty and she apologised, and that was goodness on her part, and she seemed to show genuine remorse and embarrassment over what she'd done. Now, the woman involved, Sheila O'Hearn, admitted stealing the money belonging to Kathleen Cahill, who had died 48 hours earlier in hospital. This is a Cork story, obviously. The deceased woman's son, Patrick Patsy Cahill, said he was disappointed, disgusted and saddened at what happened. Apparently, Sheila O'Hearn used to assist the dead woman when she was alive and do shopping for her and what have you. But anyway, so the guard said that she went in wearing a COVID mask and a headscarf into the credit union, and she presented herself in the name of the dead woman in the credit union. This was a credit union up in Fermoy. And she closed the account, withdrew the €21,900 that was in it. Most of that was in the form of a cheque. And then she took off the mask and the scarf and presented herself to lodge it in her own AIB account in the AIB bank. But don't you see that it was in the deceased person's name, so it couldn't be done. So she put the scarf back on and the mask, went back to the credit union and asked for it to be put in her own name, pretending that this was the name of a niece who she wanted to give the money. Anyway, it didn't matter, but these kind of changes anyway. Then she goes back to the bank again and lodges the cheque. But all of that carry-on alerted suspicion, and the Gardaí arrested her later that day. As I say, she pleaded guilty. All but €50 was recovered and stolen and given to those that actually should have got the money from the deceased account, over €21,900. And off she goes to jail now for 9 months. And, you know, that's another court report for you. That really, you kind of wonder, wow, the way people behave and the things that they get up to. And then, of course, in this country that we're supposed to be awash with cash, do you see the papers this morning where Michael McGrath is telling all of the government ministers to pull in their spending, rein in the spending, tighten the belt. They've been warned that they're spending way too much and we might require a bailout if they don't cop themselves on. Bailout. Where did I hear that word before? So we're 2.9 million over now, like 15% higher than we are this time last year. So it's all very well for them to spend what they don't have, but for the rest of us, of course, it's calamitous. And with all that's happening, it leads to chaos. Did you know, and love to chat with people maybe whose children are caught up in this, 100,000 of our children are being denied school dental checkups. This country's like a death by a thousand cuts, do you know what I mean? So school dental checks, the indication now being given from the government is, well, really now, you know, parents should really be getting their children's teeth checked privately. Oh, I see. And what was the point of PRSI? And what was the point of paying income tax? And what was the point of paying universal social charges if you get absolutely shag all for it? But there you have it nonetheless. Papers also talk about the fact that north of the border, the former leader of the DUP charged in court yesterday with 11 charges of sex offences. His wife, actually, Lady Eleanor, is also accused of aiding and abetting. So that's a lead in many of the red tops today. But something that we've dealt with on Leaside from time to time is the throwing of drugs or the use of drones to get drugs into Cork prison. It's the same in all of the prisons in Ireland. It's a front page of Making the Star today. Lovely weather for the drugs. It's kind of a wonder about, you know, a headline like that. But there it is, nonetheless. But the story to it is that the country's biggest jails, they're using drones, right? And there were nets. We had a big fall of snow there a couple of months back, and the nets in Mountjoy and Wheatfield and Clover Hill, they all fell down because of the heavy snow, and they haven't been put up since March, which means that it's open season then for throwing drugs into the courtyard. In fact, they're flying drones over the yard and they're dropping the drugs inside. They're so accurate that they can drop the drugs by drone to somebody they recognise inside in the courtyard. In fact, they can even get the drone up to the window of the prisoner, apparently, and drop it off like that. It's like Deliveroo by drone for drugs, if you like. It's an astonishing thing, isn't it? But then again, we know that drugs are very, very easily available in all of our... There's just not just drugs, actually, making the papers today regarding jails, but also the amount of prisoners. We've got over 1,000 additional prisoners now, without any beds for them in Irish prisons. So they're kind of, where there would have been one in a cell, there's two. Where there would have been two in a cell, there's four. They're sleeping on the ground. They've converted offices and storage rooms and everything now for prisoners. It's absolutely insane, the overcrowding that's going on. And of course, with more and more people coming into our country, some are saying it's overcrowding in Ireland too. But did you ever look at the figure then of those people who have been refused refugee status? They've gone through the process. They've had their hearing, they've had their appeal, and they've lost both. So there's 7,300 have been refused status since the beginning of last year. Do you want to know how many of them have actually been deported? Of the 7,300, under 100 have been deported. And it's amazing, actually, but you self-deport. You know, it's not as if the state does it or gets a plane or puts a ticket in your hand. You must self-deport yourself. So there's 7,300 people out there who should be self-deporting themselves, and only 100 have so far. It's chaos. It's another system that isn't working. And it won't work even more now because of the Rwanda policy. You know the Rwanda ruling? It was in court in Ireland about 3 or 4 weeks ago, where somebody challenged their deportation back to the UK on the basis that if they were sent back to the UK, they would be sent to Rwanda. And the court agreed. So the Rwanda ruling now will really put the cat among the pigeons with regards to deportations going forward. The amount of children, and I call them children because they're 13, 14 and 15 year olds that are now drinking, is gone through the roof. That's way up. It's very bad in the UK. I see the front of the UK Times is saying that England is worst in the world for underage drinking. They say that 33% of 11-year-olds and over half of 13-year-olds in England have drunk alcohol. We're not too far behind them ourselves. Over half of 15-year-olds have tried alcohol once already in Ireland. So they're getting younger, not just alcohol, but e-cigarettes and indeed tobacco, all being trialed and experimented with by children as young, as I say, of 11 to 15 years of age. The papers this morning also talk of the issues regarding those working in farming. On a lighter note, because of the shocking weather we've been having, the new spuds are going to be very late this year because rain, waterlogged fields, and farmers have to wait because they got to plant late and what have you. But the rain and the weather is having an awful impact on the mental health of farmers. And there's a story in the Star today saying, because of our record rainfall, ruining months of agribusinesses is threatening the mental health of pressures of farmers who were under an awful lot of pressure as it was already. And they actually give some examples of farmers who were struggling. And actually, because of the serious depression and the unrelenting weather and just life being too tough on the farm because of Irish weather and the changes in weather, those that wanted to give up and were planning to give up, and those that have already taken their own lives. There are other stories in the papers this morning, including one or two that I'm going to need, because I'm a man, I'm going to need to get some help on, if you don't mind. One of them has to do with a court case on mansplaining, and the other has got to do with the colour of paint and the popular colours for 2024. Because for me, the world is blue, yellow, red, white, green, brown, colours like that. But in the world of paint, it's more likely to be powder almond, taupe, pink coffee bean, beige. There's also a new one called greige, and then there's teal. Can I just tell you, I have no idea what even one of those colours looks like.
Taupe?
No.
Teal? Did you say teal?
Teal.
Greige? Greige?
Greige. Is there some new form of beige?
I know taupe, that's a very kind of neutral colour. That's like the new cream, I think.
Well, why don't you call it cream then?
Because it's not cream, it's taupe.
Call it off cream.
It's off cream. Or you know teal. It's
no,
like,
I don't. I do not know what it is.
It's like bluey, greeny, kind of a turquoisey.
Say green then, for God's sake.
No, it's because it's not green, but it's not blue. It's one in the middle. I'll get you some more later. We can do
it. Is that a thing that men fail to grasp? Is it very much something that women get, you know, the off colours and the different colours and the hint to this and hint to that and the elephant? What's elephant's breath?
Oh, jeez, I don't know. I think that maybe it's just because maybe women are maybe more in the side of decorating and stuff like that, so they're just more familiar with the colours or something like that.
Can you not get an app where you can just point it at the colour? You can get an app, you point it at flowers and it tells you what the flower is.
Snap,
can't you just get an app that points at the wall and it'll tell you what
colour? Could be onto something there, Neil. I'd say we could both do with a bit of that.
other one then, anyway, there's some of the colours that are in for 2024. Brown. Why would brown be in for 2024?
It's 70s, isn't it?
It's
brown.
A bit dull, like. It's a bit depressing, isn't it? Brown and yellow. I love yellow, though. Oh, it's a beautiful colour.
Brown and yellow together are kind of cool these days.
That's the combination, the same. Brown and yellow everywhere. The other one has to do with mansplaining. Do I mansplain you?
No.
I'll be honest.
No, you don't. Oh, you don't.
God. Oh, thank God for that. Because there's a guy who actually took this to a workplace relations committee and he went and lost. Right?
Okay.
What is that story? This museum worker claimed a female colleague accused him of doing the bloke thing, which is what? Mansplaining?
I suppose it was in that case, yeah. Right.
And the guy called Jonathan Murray said a female colleague went on an angry rant against men when he stepped into help her while she was doing a tour with tourists at the Ulster Folk and Transport Museum.
Yeah.
He shouldn't have stepped in.
Well, you see, I think there's a fine line between like helping and between mansplaining, I think it is clearly one or the other, and it does depend on the man in question. Women can do this, of course. You know, it's not just down to men.
What's the equivalent for women's play? Is it women's blaming? Splaining?
Can't say I've heard that term before. I think it just tends to be more on the side of men doing it to women.
What is mansplaining?
I think that it's when a man might try to explain something to a woman in a patronising or condescending way. Or
I'm going to explain this to you now, and I'm going to do it in a manner which I'm implying that you're stupid.
Exactly. And not all men do it at all. You know, like people I work with here, yourself and Seamus, like, you know, we would have a good discussion about something, sharing ideas. You'd give me advice. I'd say something back. Mansplaining is really different. It is when a man kind of gives me unsolicited advice about something. Or assumes that maybe you don't have that information, you know?
Yeah. Assuming you don't know, so I'm going to tell you anyway.
Yes.
And you would not say, I already know. You would just listen?
It depends. I think that in this case, this particular gentleman had just done it so many times that this woman was just sick of it.
She didn't go off on a rant, but what she did mutter to a female co-worker is, you're a pain in the arse.
Yes. And I think that as well, like in this article, his line manager apparently noted that he would speak to female staff regularly as though he was trying to lecture them, you know, and that whereas with men, he would ask questions or leave space for them to speak. So like, obviously this guy had a bit of a track record of speaking to women in a certain way. So I think that was the main issue with this. That
it's pretty mortifying though. You couldn't get a bigger photograph of his head and shoulders in the paper today.
I know. And then the judge said that if anyone had difficulties dealing with the opposite gender, it appears to have been the claimant, which was the man. Yeah, so
gotta wonder would he like to be able to reverse his way out of that one. Anyway, that makes the papers today. Just fine, thanks, Claire. Finally, for now, I know we live in a different world now. You watch more and more television shows; they come with all sorts of warnings. They could be trigger warnings. I know the ones about sexual references are violence and things like that. But now they're coming with all sorts of trigger warnings, particularly if you're watching comedy from the '70s, saying the views back in the '70s do not view the views that. Do not, you know, marry up now with the views of people in the 21st century. But we know of Fawlty Towers and the type of comedy and Only Fools and Horses and Alf Garnett and Steptoe and Son and stuff like that. But now, the very, very sedate, safe 1980s sitcom Terry and June is coming with trigger warnings. And viewers are being told, prepare yourself for discriminatory language of the period from the 1970s, which is unacceptable now. I mean, in all fairness, Terry and June, and one or two of the episodes from the show, actually, that are coming with trigger warnings, was an episode where Terry responded to someone who was singing at the time, saying, last time I heard screeching like that was when I accidentally vacuumed the cat. Now the fear is that animal lovers will be offended by something like that. There's another one or two that include when Terry dressed up in a Native American fancy dress. I kind of get that. But this ran from 1979 to 1987. But don't you think sometimes people kind of know? And they can make up on their own mind. They're smart enough to know that when on back there, we don't do those kind of things now, rather than having to explain and give warnings for everything. Anyway, your thoughts are welcome. Text 0868 104 106.
Call Neil now.
0818 104 106. The Neil Prendeville Show on Red FM.
Okay, I just want to alert you that you might find some of what I'm going to do next upsetting, so just be aware of that. I've been reading some of the evidence of the inquest and the tribunals over the years into the Stardust disaster that led to the deaths of 48 young people. I will talk in a moment with Patricia O'Connor, who survived the fire at the Stardust, and she will say that the number actually is 49. In some of the evidence, though, and it is quite harrowing, of those who survived, Donna Main survived it, and she has flashbacks even to this day, but she recalls being in the Stardust on that night. She says while she was at the exit door, she could hear the chain and a lock being shaken vigorously by people attempting to open the door. She could hear people saying, "The doors are effing locked. We're not getting out." People kept saying that over and over again. She said that you could see people's bodies all lying across each other between her and the exit door. And someone outside said, "Young one, move, move." An arm came in and literally pulled her out through the open exit door. She said that they were locked and chained from the inside. She wasn't the only person that actually said that. She went on to say that she said that she could hear people pushing the bars up and down, trying to open them. A chap called Patrick Behan says running into the toilets behind the stage is what he did. And he said things were so bad that he said an act of contrition and a Hail Mary into the ear of a teenage girl who was also with him in the bathroom. He said that he was eventually rescued by a fireman, but he said the fumes in the club were so toxic that that's what knocked people out. It was like a holocaust. He says the ceiling of the club collapsed while people were still on the dance floor. He said that he could see a girl about 10 feet away covered in flames, screaming and rolling around the floor. Now, some might find this too graphic, and my apologies for it. Someone had a hook with a curve on the end of it and tried to use it to pull her out, but they couldn't. Eventually, when she stopped screaming, he presumed she was dead and ran out of the club, he said. There's a man called, the man now, but a young teenager at the time, David Carroll, said at the time he worked in the Stardust for 2 months and he was working there, he said it was normal to see the chains on the doors. He says he ran to exit 5 and there were people lying on the ground. He had to walk over them to get to the door. He said there was a chain on the door. He tried and tried and tried, but failed to open it and gave up. He said people were gasping for air on the ground. He saw debris falling from the ceiling. He saw a girl's dress on fire. He said he believed the girl died in the fire because he didn't see her come out. So a man called Patrick Morgan, who was a teenager at the time, said he saw someone on fire as he tried to escape. He said he lay on the ground with others who had collapsed in the club before he got one breath of air and crawled towards the exit. There's a man called Paul Walker, who was 17, went back in and grabbed a girl who was on fire and he pulled her out. A chap called Patrick Crowe said that he was at home on the night of the Stardust, but on occasions in the 3 years preceding the fire, he had been there when the power failed for no apparent reason. Now, we know about the power issues regarding the Stardust now. The jury found that this fire started in the hot press in the main bar. It was an electrical fault that then spread everywhere. There were electrical issues in the Stardust for quite some time. Dickie Rock refused to play there on at least one occasion because the power would fail. And so there was something going on there that led in the end to the deaths of all of these young people. One person who did survive was Dubliner Patricia O'Connor, and she joins me by WhatsApp. Patricia, good morning.
How are you, Niall? I'm good. You have to bring me back there.
I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. And that's
no,
why
you're
I wanted
grand,
to alert
it's
people.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because
you live, of course, not just with the memories, but the sounds of that night as well. Isn't that
oh,
right?
Oh, God, yeah. Yeah, like, I don't think there's anyone that was there that night that can't just close their eyes and see it, or go asleep and see it and hear, because when the music stopped, it was a big place, the music stopped, and, you know, God, the noise of the fire going across the ceiling, the lights going out, all you could hear was screams, you know, "Mommy, Daddy, help me." It was just, you know, it was just like, so there the sounds, like, still get goosebumps, there the sounds and the voices that I still hear, that others still hear, you know.
Teenagers
hard
calling out for
out.
Their mammies and their daddies to come
and their daddies
them.
And help me, yeah, you know.
And Patricia, can I just ask you to recall call that night? Because I know you went with a couple of pals. One of them, of course, didn't survive, your very good friend Caroline Carey. She was 17. And that's why, the case of Caroline, you say that the number 48 deaths is incorrect.
Caroline was expecting a baby at the time. She was pregnant. Yeah. So, you know, the other day, the Taoiseach make an acknowledgement of that and a recognition of Caroline that she was pregnant, brings it up to 49. I totally get and I totally understand why the families of the 48, because it wasn't out there. It wasn't out there that Caroline was pregnant, not to my knowledge, you know. So, but the Taoiseach acknowledged it the other day, and now Caroline has acknowledged that she was pregnant. Her family have that acknowledgement. So it's a bit of a relief, to be honest with you, you know what I mean? Yeah. So I hope that it's recognised somewhere, you know.
So we are talking about the early 80s, when there was a lot of unemployment and poverty and emigration, and a little enough for a teenager to look forward to, except the dancing competitions at the Stardust. So off you went on that night, all of you pals together. 850 ultimately went in there. It was a big club. And you went off then full of joy, right? Full of happiness.
Grey Farm, skipping down the road. Misty night it was, you know, and there was a fog sort of in the air, you know, and myself, the girl next door, Angela, and we went up and called for Caroline, and then we all went down, you know, and like it was packed. It was more packed than normal because of the fine of the disco dancing competition, so it was a bit more packed, so I didn't sit in my normal seat. I went up the back, which had a tiered level, you know, you go up and then you go up again. I was up on a height, and someone just, you know,
where did Caroline go? Was she meeting someone else then, or?
Caroline was meeting her fella. Caroline went off to meet her fella, and there was other friends, and we were all friends, but you had other groups of friends. There was, you know, there was so many. We all knew each other, you know, like there were fellas who died. They worked on the meat counter in Super Queen, you know, they worked in other shops. People knew each other to say hello to, you know, recognised each other, you know. Yeah.
And what?
It was a very close community. Yeah. It was a close community.
And what,
you know,
did you become alerted to first? What happened?
Just the announcement of the DJ that don't panic, but someone had already sort of alerted me to the right, and when I looked over, now I'm talking about a good distance away, and there was a fire not about 2 foot high. And it looked like it was under a sea. You know, it looked like it was under to the side of a sea. And by the time I stood up, the announcement had been made, literally stepped down my seat, stood up and turned around to pick up my coat. The place was in darkness. This just came across the ceiling. And the fella that was sitting in front of me said, get on the floor, hold on to me feet, hold on to me legs. It all happened. This is split seconds, you know. So I have to be honest, and I'm not being dramatic. If he hadn't moved, I wouldn't have moved. It was pitch black. There was a palpable smoke, you know. You're just trying to hold your mouth closed to, you know, move. When he moved, I moved. I don't know how he made it to that exit with me behind him, because it was down and to the left. When we got there, and there was a girl, I remember when we got to the exit, and how I could see this, because the doors were, you know, not fully open, but, three quarters way, you know, that way, boat. And there were steps down, and when I got to the steps, something off the ceiling fell on me back, so I couldn't move, you know, but I could see people outside. Yeah.
Previous to that, of course, as you were crawling and holding on to this lad's legs, the ceiling started to melt. We're talking about molten I don't know, was this tar?
I wasn't burnt by fire.
No, but you were over 52%
of your body. Yeah, 58%, yeah. But, and it wasn't by, it was dripping. This was dripping like oil is the only way I can describe it. Dripping, dripping, dripping. You know, and then the piece of ceiling fell on me back. Like, but I put my hand up and someone stepped in, put their hand down and pulled me out. And I got out and I had no clothes. Like, I remember seeing myself, but it's not really registering, if that makes sense. You know, that, you know, my clothes had melted into my arms and, you know what I mean? I'm looking down at myself and my skin is hanging out my arms breathe. And so, but it's not sort of registering in a way. The pain is just, it's just gotten so bad. I don't know where it goes, but that's what happens, you know?
As in, one would think you would be feeling horrific, unbearable pain, but you're suggesting you weren't. Shock.
Yes, I don't know what it is, but you know, you start to feel the pain then. Believe me, you start to feel it then. But it's just, I stood up and I can only describe, like I said, I literally sat and the fella just was wrapping skin around my arms because it was just from my arms, my shoulders, my back. I couldn't see my back. I could, you know, and I didn't realise the noises and the screams I was hearing. My mind didn't realise why people were looking at me the way they were, and you know. But
was there chaos all around you then, with others coming out or attempting to get people out, or were there paramedics and ambulances and fire brigades?
No, I didn't see that like that, because when I came out, they just brought me to the left of where I got out and around, and a man was getting into his car, and the two people I was with that was carrying me said she needs to get to the hospital. They put me in the car and they just brought me to the matter, you know. That's what happened. But like, I remember that car journey, like it was just horrific. You know, I was feeling it then. It's just, it's a mental thing, you know.
And you're just shy of your 17th birthday when all of this is happening, yeah. Of course. And that lad that you held on to his legs, do you know who he was? I mean, did you ever catch up with him, or was he a pal of yours?
No, I didn't. No, he was a pal at the time. He was in a group. He was in a group of friends that I knew. His name is Tony. I knew him. I knew them all at the time. And no, I haven't seen him since. Yeah, do you know what? Like, because, you know, I remember coming home from hospital, and as much as I had what's called survivor's guilt regarding Caroline not coming home, people had it for me too, and I didn't notice at the time, you know. And because I was in hospital for a long time, then I got home and then I couldn't go out for a while. I couldn't go out for a long time, apart from not wanting to go out. I was afraid to go out, and then covered in bandages. I'm 17, different, didn't want to live like this, didn't, you know, and no counselling, nothing like that offered, absolutely nothing. Going to the hospital every day, change of bandages, going in, you know, have my lungs cleaned out, getting measured for these JOP suits, they were called, body suits, you know, so to flatten the, as a result of skin grafts, the skin lumps and all, and bones, and had to flatten all. So it was an endless thing, you know what I mean? So didn't see really a lot of people, and that's not their fault. Nobody knew how to deal with this, nobody.
And when did you find out that 48 and an unborn baby had perished?
Well, I knew Caroline was pregnant, you know, so I knew that night, Carol. But, like, if I'm honest, I can't really remember finding out. I know I didn't know in hospital. And then I was in a ward with another girl and a young country girl that was in there for something. And there was no television in Dr. Stephen's hospital. And something came up. I remember asking my mum when she came up. So you're not only told, you know, one person is dead. 48. like 48 real living people that we saw every other day in the supermarket, in the shop, going around the corner, going to the down. Like, this was, it was something a 16, 17 year old mind can't take in. You quickly take it in when you go home, you know, and you quickly realise that life has changed forever. It will never be the same again for anyone, you know, ordinary people in that area, you know, it was never to be the same again. You know, it affected everybody, everybody.
And the injuries that you suffered, of course, in spite of all of the medical intervention and the skin grafting and the gels for the pain and the wrapping and the bandaging, did you come to terms with the injuries? Because your body, you're a young teenage girl.
No.
No, you didn't? No?
I have, I'm coming to terms with them now. And I'm not going to lie. As Mary Lou said, there was suicides, there was addictions, there was all that. Yeah, I went down that road of addiction. And I tried to, because I didn't want this body. I didn't want to be this person that had to present themselves to the world this way in relationships. Relationships broke up because I had no comprehension of what was happening to me. I had no comprehension of what was happening to me family. None of us knew how to deal with it. So, yeah, I went down that road of addiction. And thankfully today I am free. I'm in recovery. And to say I'm grateful for the McDermotts, for Jimmy, for the Keegans, for Maurice Fraser, do you know what I mean? For Mrs. Barrett, for all them, for carrying this all these years so that I was able to sit in that doll and sit in that court and hear that. Those people and that campaign enabled that for me. So I am so grateful. I really am, you know.
What was
the reaction
like at the verdict? Because it took a couple of seconds for it to sink in, I think.
Oh, my God. It was just, there was such apprehension in the court beforehand. You know, there was just a quiet, nervous apprehension from people. You could feel it. You know, you could feel the energy in the room. And then the courtroom was packed from relatives, families, people, friends. And then she came out and she asked him, had they reached a verdict? And he said, yeah, a majority verdict. But she asked him to go through and yes, that they found that because the doors were locked and chained, that people died, that all the lists, one by one, it was people, hadn't been enough training, you know, all of these things, yes, and as yes was going on, oh my God, my heart was in my mouth. And she asked him, how do you reach a verdict? He said, yes, the same for everyone, you know, the same for everyone. Unlawful kill. And the place just erupted. I was sitting beside a lady and I can see, and a man, and they lost their sister. The man just put his head in his lap and cried, like, and the woman just hugged me. My daughter was sitting beside me, and it was just marvellous.
Some of the reasons why, because for over 43 years, it was counterclaimed that the exits weren't chained or locked. It was counterclaimed for many years that it was arson, that it was started and deliberately by a punter.
Yeah.
But no one really in your community believed any of that.
Nobody believed it because we knew, but you know, as Charlie Board said, if this had happened in Donnybrook, this would have been sorted long, long, long ago. But I tell you something, the spirit of the North Side people and the spirit of that campaign is no matter what they were told, no matter how many no's they got, how many times they were turned away, their backs turned on them, everything, they didn't give up because they knew the truth. We knew the truth. Anybody that was there and involved, we didn't lie. We didn't lie. And to be have that arson, improbable arson, stuck on a community, well, that sticker is well off now.
You believe many do that it was because it was a working class community and treated differently accordingly.
Personally, yes, I do believe it, without a shadow of a doubt. Yeah, I do. Like, you know, I remember Mr. Keegan, Antoinette Keegan's father, starting up that in the Camelot Hotel.
Antoinette lost her two sisters.
Antoinette lost her two sisters, and her mammy and daddy were toiled. Neither of them lived to see this out. My mammy didn't live to see. Jimmy Fitzpatrick's mammy. So many mammies, daddies, brothers, sisters, aunties, uncles didn't live to see this out. And those people carried that all these years because they knew the truth.
And
they
knew it. Have you carried the memory every single day of your life?
Oh, for God, I've carried a memory. I've carried it because I didn't know how to deal with it. And I'm not making excuses here that I was any different to anybody else. I didn't know how to deal with it. I couldn't accept myself the way I was. I couldn't accept things because there was no talking about it. You know, I didn't talk about it. People didn't talk about it. So, you know, I just didn't know how to deal with it. You know what I mean? But this has given freedom. I finally feel like a grown woman now that, you know, like the stardust is... All right, it's there. There's so much more to be done, and that's down to the families and the solicitors. But there has to be accountability and charges here, I believe. Mm. But that's down to the families and so. But like, you know, this 43 years, like where it's wrong. It has all been wrong. But like now, I dealt with it in my way, and thankfully I was present there. I'm in recovery, I'm free, and it's just so brilliant to be still alive. I'm just so grateful to be still alive.
And I'm so grateful that you took time to talk to us this morning. You were also there for the apology, yeah?
I was, yes. Yeah. The apology. Yeah.
Here's how long ago it was, from a man, the Taoiseach, Simon Harris, who wasn't even born when the Stardust disaster tragedy happened.
Yeah, amazing,
that's
isn't
how long,
it?
That's
isn't
how long it? It's been going on.
Yeah, it's just mental. You know, I used a phrase the other day, like, the shame of a thousand men were in their laps. Like, you know, in their laps the other day in that doll. And it's like, so... Yeah, I heard it and it was transparent, if that's what you say. It was apology and it was all of that, you know, and I'm listening and it was a bit sort of surreal and I was looking around at people, you know, these tired faces, these young faces and, you know, people were crying because it's like, Jesus, after all these years, and here it is, you know.
It had to be done, though. It had to be done for Caroline Carey and others like
that. Without question. Like, but I tell you, it was done, it has been done, and if it hadn't been done, these people would be still fighting. Yeah. But it has been done. And there was passionate speeches in that, in the doll, you know. Mm. There was other, you know, so, but it was just... It was walking out just, I felt that bit lighter. You know, that the process now was starting, the process, you know, but it was the verdict. It was the judge, the coroner, it was the jury. They were just brilliant, you know, and that gave... me anyway, that lift to say, okay, even though I knew I was telling the truth and I knew everyone else was telling the truth, you know, of course, you know, to have a jury to know the truth, that they've looked at all the evidence, that makes a difference, you know.
Absolutely. So thank you so much, Patricia, this morning.
I know
you've been very busy with media the last few days. It's not easy, but thank you for chatting with us.
Thank you. Have a good day. Okay, thanks. Bye-bye.
Lovely Patricia O'Connor. Still hears the cries of the people calling for their mammies and daddies as they try to escape. Text 0868 104 106 back after these.
Text or WhatsApp Neil now. 0868
104 106. The Neil Prendeville Show on Red FM.
Just jumping in because I wanted to talk for as long as I could with Patricia O'Connor to hear her story and to relive those horrible, horrible times and that awful tragedy, which now we know was unlawful killing. Paul in Toker says, let's not forget every successive government over the past 40 years plus who did nothing to help the families. Don't forget them. In fact, they did everything in their powers to put obstacles in front of any inquiry the families were involved in. They should all, over the decades, hang their heads in shame. Neil, I did a fire warden course years ago. One of the videos was a reconstruction of the Stardust in a plane hangar in Dublin, using the same seating and the same materials. This is astonishing. It got so bad that the whole hangar was nearly lost. They struggled to extinguish the reconstruction before it spread around and burnt down the hangar, which it didn't, but they struggled to extinguish it before it did. That is incredible. Somebody doing a fire warden course where they reconstructed the Stardust in a plane hangar in Dublin, and you could see, while on that course, the devastation of the fire and the smoke and the toxicity and the molten product, whatever it was that the ceilings were made of, dripping down upon people. And that's why Patricia had such extensive body burns. Heartbreaking, says Eilish this morning. So keep them coming. Text 0868 104 106. I think it's important to hear from the survivors. It's an amazing thing because over and over again, you hear of survivor guilt, survivor guilt. I survived, others didn't. Why me? Why not them? Back after 10.
The Neil Prendeville Show on Red FM. Conversation that matters.
Be part of the conversations. The Neil Prendeville Show with Mercedes-Benz Cork. With regards to our jails, and these are texts from the first hour of the show this morning, with the country's jails one-fifth over capacity and no new ones being built, there has to be an overhaul of the system. First of all, jails should not be for people with mental health issues, full stop. With 25% non-nationals in jail, they could be just automatically deported. At the end of the day, jail should only be for violent criminals who commit murder, armed robbery, and rape. You don't send someone to jail for the non-payment of a television license. Interesting perspective. Agree or disagree? Text 0868 104 106. On our roads, there needs to be more Gardaí on the roads in unmarked cars, observing people's driving. They should be hiding behind walls, checking for speed. The way it is now, it's not working. I see it every day with people wandering all over the roads. It's interesting. I mean, there isn't a week goes by, you know, there, thereabouts, that I don't see an unmarked car with the siren up in it, pulling somebody into the slow lane, sorry, into the hard shoulder, because the car is not emblazoned with, you know, the Garda Síochána livery and signage. I saw a very strange thing. I thought it was fantastic marketing. But about a week ago, I was driving over the bridges, heading to pick somebody up at the train station. And coming against me was what I thought was a big Garda SUV. But it wasn't. It's a marketing company that uses all sorts of, uses similar colouring as if it was a Garda SUV, and on the side of it, it says FBI. I mean, it is good marketing. I mean, you would be attracted to it. You'd automatically think it was a Garda car, but it wasn't. Or one of, you'd almost think it was one of the, you know, rapid armed patrol cars that they have, but it wasn't. It was marketing company with FBI up on the side of it, Federal Bureau of Investigation. I said to myself, when did these guys hit town? On all those taxes you just mentioned, it's just theft of the public in broad daylight and everyone just accepts it. We pay all the taxes, like you said, and what's the point in paying if you get nothing in return? Well, things are so chaotic now that over 100,000 children aren't getting the checks that they should be getting with regards to dental in primary school. The indication that I got from it was that the government is saying, go away and get it done privately. Your PRSI in USC is being used to pay for the homes of refugees and immigrants. Did you not know that? Well, there are 4,000 Irish children going homeless. Okay. And then on colours, I could spend all morning talking about colour. I'm not colourblind or anything like that. I just see things more in basic colours, to be honest with you. I'm a painter and decorator by trade, Neil, and this year, Egyptian cotton is the most popular colour for inside. The greys are going out since last year, says Grey. I can understand. I don't know anybody who would paint grey. I mean, maybe, what is that? Do you ever see a gunpowder grey? That's a nice colour for cabinets and doors and worktops, though. Maybe I'm wrong on grey. Now that I think of it, I think our cabinets are grey. But anyway, Egyptian cotton, that's kind of off-white. So just say off-white. Can I just stay with that topic? No, I'm not getting there. Have a list. Yeah, there's a list here of different colours, right? And there are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 different colours for green. Honeydew, lime, spring, clover, fern, moss and flora. There are 4 different colours for blue. Spindrift, teal, sky and turquoise. Why can't they just say light blue, middling blue, dark blue? Same with green. Then you've got banana and lemon for yellow. And they're both the same to me. Color of a banana and the color of a lemon are both... No, it won't stop. They're the same. A banana's yellow and a lemon is yellow. And then they've got ones called teal, tawny, ochre. What's ochre when it's at home? Viridian, ecru, vermilion and cyan. Don't even get me started on the different colours for pink. There's even a paint called bubblegum. Bubblegum. Who paints their wall bubblegum? But anyway, keep them coming. Text 0868 104 106. I'm doing a skydive fundraiser in aid of a charity called Deborah Ireland. They provide support and information for families affected by rare skin conditions. It means the affected people have to live their whole lives with butterfly skin. Really? So the reason I'm doing the skydive is for the bravery of my 4-year-old niece, Bonnie, who suffers with it. A quick mention from you would make a huge difference for the fundraiser. Appreciate it if you can, says James Stanton. Well, if you go on and you want to help James Stanton with his skydive, go on to idonate.ie/fundraiser/sponsor Bonnie13. And good luck with the skydive, Jamie. Let me know how it goes. Come back and fill us in. No money for children's dental care, but 12 million for cats and dogs per annum. Oh my God, when you put it like that, I'm sitting up and paying attention. No money for children's dental care, but 12 million for cats and dogs. You have Micheál Martin in the Middle East getting involved when they need to solve issues at home, for God's sake. Tánaiste will meet ministers in Egypt and Jordan to discuss the possibility of an Israeli-Hamas ceasefire, the release of hostages and humanitarian aid for Gaza. I hope that he's there, that he has some success. Back after the break, text 0868 104 106. Calls on the way.
Call Neil now. 0818 104 106.
The Neil Prendeville Show on Red FM.
Lots of calls, texts and emails between now and midday, but just staying, following my conversation just before 10 with regards to the those that lost their lives and those that survived the Stardust fire. John Burns on too. John, do you mind if I just recap on a couple of bits, because it's important to what you want to say, right? The Keane Tribunal was first out of the blocks in 1981. You might remember at that time Charlie Haughey was the Taoiseach. He was a local TD for the area. Now, that one, this is named after Justice Ronan Keane, concluded that the probable cause of the blaze was probable arson rather than an accident. Probable arson would mean that it was deliberate. You recall that. This was also the one where the Stardust owner, Butterley's, got a claim paid out of €580,000 compensation for malicious damage, because the findings of that tribunal at the time says probable arson. So they got €580,000. There was another one then in 1985 where some families took a case looking for compensation as well. And that was also heard but just parked by the state. No closure at all. Then in 2008, there was the one called the Coffee Report. And the Coffee Report was interesting because that one said that the original verdict in 1981 should be struck from the public record because the likely cause of arson, according to this report, this inquiry, this tribunal, the likely cause of arson was in grave doubt. And that's where it sat then until the McCartan Report in 2017. There was potentially new evidence came out. I'm reading from the journal online from some weeks back. And the judge involved in that criticised the evidence presented to him and then said that there was no new inquiry warranted. So again, time after time after time after time, disappointment and closed doors for the families. Then came, where we're at now, the Stardust inquiries that led us to where we were last week. So I think you wanted to pick up on that. All of these tribunals, inquiries, reports, yeah?
Yeah, the only thing that could stop that would be political interference.
Which, no, I don't know about that. You appoint a judge in every one of these cases, whether it's a compensation tribunal, yeah, the Keane tribunal, the Coffee one. They're all judges, you know?
Yeah, but where's the original fire chief's report on the file?
Don't know the answer to that. I imagine it's filed.
Yeah, but so how can we get a new report now that's overriding that? So which one?
I imagine the inquest got access to the original fire reports from 81.
Yeah, but so there was a report there that you read out there that was parked by the government.
Yeah. Yeah.
But so, I mean, that's political interference for the government to put it on hold and kick it down the road, hoping that would go away. Much akin to what the British government done with the Hillsborough inquiry, but the people there also stuck to their guns, and they got closure on it. The fact that the police were wrong in their report. So we have reports flying left, right, and centre that are now proving to be inconclusive, and you must remember that Simon Harris, as you said, wasn't even born, but some of the people still in government who kicked it down the road are still in government, along with the president, who was a member of three governments when he was a minister.
Yeah, but I suppose you would say the best that a politician could do at the time would be to hand it over to an independent tribunal.
Yeah, but why weren't they pushing to get a resolve for the families because of 43 people?
Okay, let me try and answer that for you. They would have said that all they had to deal with and work with was the Keane Tribunal of 1981. Malicious damage started the fire, probable arson. And sure, how could they push back against that?
Yeah, but hold on a while now.
I mean, I know that there were agitators and those that were supporting the... agitators is the wrong word. But there were those that were supporting the family. I mean, Joe Duffy was very much front and centre of it since the off. So was Charlie Byrne. And they say that the dogs on the street knew it wasn't malicious. The dogs on the... like, yeah. There was all sorts of electrical problems there for years, apparently.
Yeah, yes. But if would the owners of the building have got a payout from the insurance company?
It wasn't an insurance company payout. It was from the state.
The
Butterleys got £580,000 at the time for malicious damage from Dublin Council.
Yeah, but the building was surely insured. So obviously, that if they would bring in their own investigators, and they would have found out if it was electrical or malicious, and there may have been no payout because it was inadequate maintenance by the people who owned the building.
It was
electrical.
I can't talk to that. I don't know anything about that. I mean, there is now the possibility of a criminal investigation on Garda Síochána will be looking at all of these events very closely, because now we have unlawful death. So unlawful killing must be investigated as a criminal offence.
Yeah, but who are they going to be investigating? The people that put it on hold and kicked it down the road?
That I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I don't know who you would find. I don't know who you could actually point a finger of culpability to.
Well, we have a lot of politicians who are quite happy to let it slide and to hope that the people would give up and that they'd die off, that they should be thinking about resigning. One amongst them would be Michael D. Higgins, who, as I said, who was a minister in three governments. He surely has a liability to the people of the country. You know?
I'd have to look deeply into that to see what Michael D. was saying about it all through the 80s and 90s.
Tell me, I mean, is the fire chief still alive that wrote the
I don't know. I do know that one question that I haven't heard being asked is as to whether the malicious damages claim of £580,000 should be repaid to the state.
Oh, I said it's long gone. I said, well spent. I said, well invested in something else. You know, but it should. I mean,
well, if you got a compensation claim for something that transpired later that you shouldn't have got it because of new evidence, I wonder if an insurance company say, "Ah, sure, he is that well spent. We leave him alone." Doubt
yeah,
it.
Yeah, but that's fraud. It wouldn't be fraud.
No, it wouldn't be fraud because it wouldn't. It wouldn't have been knowingly fraud at the time if the tribunal said maliciously started. I'm saying now in 2024 we know it to be different. Should there be a criminal investigation? Should the £580,000 be repaid because of what we know now?
Yeah, but you hold on a while. If we know now that it wasn't malicious, that means that there's a fraudulent claim.
No, it could only be. I'm not a legal. But you couldn't accuse somebody of fraud now for something that happened 43 years ago, because it wasn't fraud then. It was a payout for deliberate arson. So that's not fraud.
Yes, but they're now saying that it wasn't deliberate arson.
Yeah. But that couldn't have been a fraud in the 80s. It couldn't have been a fraud. It couldn't have been.
Why did the government feel fit to pay out on a claim that happened to be a stronghold of the Fianna Fáil government?
Why did they...
That was Charlie Hawley's bailiwick up there.
Yeah, he was the TD for the area. He was the TD.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah.
And, no, listen... Unfortunately, like everything else, this smells and it don't smell of just smoke.
Okay. A lot of collusion going on, so, with different politicians and political parties.
Would not be the first time that something was kicked down the road in the hope that it would disappear.
Okay, all right, as always.
And all the people, unfortunately, are going to be looking at is a statue and getting the back of their head rubbed and going off with, you know. As you said, there has to be an inquiry now into how 43 young people
48.
And who... 48, and who is responsible, and who's responsible for the pain and suffering of their families?
Yes, I agree.
For all the years that they went
I agree. Thank you, John. I agree. 48 children and an unborn baby. Text 0868 104 106. Pick up the phone on 0818 104 106. I just wanted to applaud your various topics on the show, particularly the recent one about men and men these days. I don't know whether you're including me in these, you know, as to whether you believe that all men do not pull their weight, all men pull the door out in the morning and just head off to work and they forget about everything in the home or any of the issues that might be going on, and it's all down to women. But big response to that, our female partners, I suppose. I just want to applaud you on the topic of show how men are these days. It's exactly the life I'm living, including the story of the mother-in-law you had on air. This is the mother-in-law where the son has a special phone for his mammy and they talk every single day. She involves in his life in way too many ways and also tells him, you know, if the relationship goes south, there's always a bed for you here at home. He goes over for his dinner and everything. Anyway, it's exactly the life I'm living, including the whole mother-in-law as well. He's a grown, spoiled brat who thinks he's so entitled to everything. Drink, drugs, gambling, women. I have no clue as to why he married me, but he changed the day I married him. And it's a comfort to know now from your program that I'm not the only woman going through this. I stay as positive as I can. I've made a life of my own with my children, and I pray every night that one day I will get out of here and away from him and his entitled family. I will use the tools that I have learned to see signs in future relationships. And also, I will watch out for my children's relationships. Thank you for bringing up the topic. Well, thank you for getting in touch. I hope things do work out for you and you will get out of here, as you say. If men were saying that about women, I can only imagine what would happen or be said. But women can say whatever they want and be critical about men. It's disgusting, you know. Women would be on your show for a week if they could, complaining about men. And they'd be on the air for another week if it was men complaining about women. For all the women bashing men, they say men do nothing around the house. Men are lazy. Men are selfish. Men are stupid. But I ask the question, Neil, who is more stupid, the men who are all those things are the stupid women who choose to have kids with and marry these stupid men. I would love to know the answer. How about getting to know someone before having kids with them? How about getting to know someone before you marry them? Thank you kindly, says Mark. Can't come on air, incidentally, because I'm working two jobs to support my wife and child. And one final one for now. A lot of people are tarnishing men on your program. Some people may be unfortunate, but the men in our household all pull their weight. My father cooks dinners, cleans the house, and so does my mam. We all help each other out at home, and nobody should be saying all men are the same and all men are lazy. It's generalizing men and creating a toxic feminine society. I'm a 19-year-old girl and love all the men in my life. I understand other households may not be as lucky as mine, but it's making husbands and fathers out to be a joke, and that we have dopey dad stereotypes. Maybe some women tell their husbands how useless they are on a daily basis, and that man has finally given up then, trying his best. Love the show, listen every day. And that's somebody bigging up all of the men in her home, and nice to hear it. Back after the break, pick up the phone, 0818 104 106.
The Neil Prendeville Show on Red FM.
Conversation that matters.
Okay, I just want to update you on a story that's breaking this morning now. Owen English in the Examiner and also Cork Bio have an up-to-date report on the Gardaí investigating the accident, the incident that led to the ultimate death some days later of Sheila Dunn. You might recall that, and we were all tragically, we're all very upset when we heard of the tragic loss of a lovely woman whose husband, Ted Dunn, had died some years previously and they left children. The update to that now is that a woman's been arrested. A woman in her 40s has been arrested by the Gardaí investigating the fatal Glanmire collision. I'm reading from Owen English's copy this morning. Now, Sheila died following a single vehicle collision in February. Owen English this morning is saying a woman has been arrested by Gardaí investigating the death of a woman following a road crash near Cork City 2 months ago. Gardaí said the woman who's been arrested is in her 40s. Is being detained under Section 4 of the Criminal Justice Act and is being detained at a Cork Garda station for questioning about the incident near Glanmire on February 11th. Now, Sheila Dunn, a mother of two in her 50s, died following the single vehicle collision. She died in hospital after the vehicle in which she was travelling with a second woman crashed at Sarsfield Court down Glanmire Way on February 11th. Now, the SUV in which they were travelling in was found on his side, lying on the driver's side. Cork City Fire Service had to use cutting equipment to access the women. Sheila Dunn was rushed in critical condition to Cork University Hospital, where she died 2 days later. The other woman who was in the car was not seriously injured in the crash. Now, Sheila Dunn is understood to have been found on the driver's seat side of the vehicle. The nature of some of her injuries led to the Gardaí suspicious about this, about whether she may have been actually the passenger in the vehicle at the time of the crash. Gardaí at Glanmire Station have been investigating the incident, which involved an extensive trawl of hours of CCTV footage. And in a statement this morning, they confirmed an arrest in the case. And that arrest is of a woman in her 40s, arrested by Gardaí, investigating the fatal collision, and held at a Cork Garda station for questioning. Cork BO also pick up on it, and they say that she can be detained for a maximum of 24 hours before being charged or released. They are, the woman's in her 40s, as I say, currently detained under Section 4 of the Criminal Justice Act at a Cork Garda station. No more than that can I tell you. If there are any further updates, we'll bring them to air. Text 0868104106. Pick up the phone on 0818104106. Lots of other texts saying, just one final one on dads. We would be lost without my husband. He works three jobs. Any free time, which he doesn't get a lot of, he spends with us. We have two kids and we would be absolutely lost without him. Don't be tiring every man with the same brush. So thank you for that. I will come back to calls. But boy, what a lovely chat we had yesterday with Bill Abou, one of the Echo Boys from back in the day. And of course, that fabulous production of the Echo Boy show that's on at the Cat Club. Seamus was lucky enough to snaffle a ticket and went last night and absolutely thoroughly enjoyed it. But I can tell you what, we've had a great response to the nostalgic stories and memories of the Echo Boys, because there's only one left now. But back in the day, another Echo Boy who earned his stripes on the streets of Cork was Con Hurley. Con, good morning.
Good morning, Neil. How are you?
I tell you something, you were one of 21 children.
Yes, one of 21. Wow. When I was being so young, but like most of them passed away because of TB, and the last one I remember was my little baby brother Michael, who passed away after 3 months. You know, he would be not the only one that I would remember, but listening to my elder brothers and sisters, they were telling me that was two sets of twins passed away as well, and I was a twin myself, and my twin sister unfortunately has passed away the last 13 years. You know?
And in the early days of their lives, TB was rampant.
It was indeed, yes. It was rampant, yes. And it was just kind of mesmerizing for my sister, like when she see the priests and the nuns coming to the door every so often, you know, coming in and bringing in, I suppose, some stuff, some foodstuffs and things like that, because there were hard times back then as well, you know.
Where'd you live? Where were you reared?
I lived in the north side of the city.
Okay, like Billaboo, he was within the peal of the Shandon Bells. Did you know him?
Yes. Oh, I did, yeah. Billaboo, a lovely character. And, you know, I was just listening yesterday, and, like, I was one of the 34 of the cast, you know, that unfortunately I opted out because of medical reasons, you know, my knees and my back, I severe pain. And, you know, I did try it. I tried it for the first 3 weeks.
Ah, the head was willing, but the body thought otherwise.
Yeah,
I know.
Yeah, and the body thought otherwise, yes.
So your man married at 19, had 21 children. They all didn't survive, God help them. And she passed away at 52. She had a young life.
52 years of age, yeah. You know, to sad, you know, very, very, very sad for my siblings and for my dad and for the rest of the family as well, you know.
Okay, where'd you go to primary school?
I went to the school, it was called the New School on Cathedral Road. It was built in 1933 and it was called the Cathedral School. And one of the men of the city, who we well know, would be Sean O'Shea, he was my teacher. In school as well.
The pucker. He's still alive and well out the Douglas Road. I see the pucker off and going for his walk.
He is indeed, yes.
He's a great man, the pucker. Yeah. So did you take up selling echoes while you were a small fella, like in primary school?
Yeah, I took up selling the echoes when I was 10 years of age. And the reason why I done that is because my brother, Donal, had taken up the papers about a year previously, and he was forever hinting at me, come on down and give me a hand. So I went down and gave him a hand, and his first pitch was above in the county hall, you know, and we used to go put the papers up to the county hall, and we'd wait for the lifts to go up and down 33 floors, like, and we knew that the walkers wasn't finished till about 5 o'clock, so to pass away the time, we used to walk up the Western Road up to past John A. Woods, you know, we'd go into John A. Woods factory, and then we'd head up to the Coca-Cola factory, and it was fantastic because, like, we were all excited about selling the papers, but we were all excited what we were getting in our pockets coming back as well, with loads of bottles of Coke. And,
did they give you bottles of Coke at the Coca-Cola
plant? Did you? We made sure when we went up we had plenty of pockets and the jackets.
Very generous up there, you know, the bottling plant.
But you looked after us very well.
So every day, how many echoes would you have brought to the county hall?
Well, we'd have bought about 80 to the county hall. You know, because, like, we'd know really, like, we said through the previous couple of days, like, how many we'd sell, you know, and we'd have an idea rather than killing ourselves with 200 papers or 300 papers, you know.
And what do you remember, if you go way, way, way back, way before you were born, there were three editions of it. Well, when you were an Echo Boy, was there two editions?
There was two editions, yeah. There was the early paper and there was the evening paper, but all the sports as well. You know, all the different sports that came out separately as
but
well.
But surely people wouldn't want the first edition then at all, so they wouldn't?
Well, I suppose, like, a lot of people would really, because they'd be out early to catch the news for the jobs and for, some people be looking for jobs, and it's very hard to get jobs then, you know, and that would be one of the reasons why as well, that they'd be getting the papers early, would be looking for the jobs.
Okay, so how much per echo did you make? How much, like, the echo would have been a couple of pence, shilling or something, I don't know.
The echo would have been, we say, the old 10p. right? It would have been 8p, so we'd get 10p, or if somebody asked for three papers, we'd get 20p, and they tell us keep the change, you know what I mean? Or 30p, or even 50, they tell us keep the change. And sometimes I'd actually end up with more tips than getting paid.
Okay, well, the tips are one thing, that's fantastic, but what were the Crosbys giving you per echo?
Well, it wasn't actually the Crosbys. It was actually, my boss was actually Donald Manny, and his father was the very first man I met, was Johnny Manny at the end of Fair Hill when we used to collect our Sunday morning paper.
I remember Johnny Manny.
Yeah, Johnny Manny. And they had the public house down below at the end of Fair Hill, and we used to collect them there, and we used to be brought to our destinations then. But, like, it was 2p at one stage, then it went up to 4p. It depends on what way it would turn around for you, which are selling your papers. And sometimes we get extra papers in the bundle, but it would be kind of a machine for, you know?
Yeah.
But them extra papers were for us.
So they were bonus. They were pure profit.
So,
would you make, and did you do this 5 days a week or 6 days a week?
I done it 7 days a week, actually.
Sunday papers?
Sunday papers as well, yeah, I did indeed, Jim. And I had my own pitch around the city. Like, I had my pitch there on the South Main Street outside the Liberty Bar with Gerard Cronin, Lord of Mercy. He was my boss. He was the man that was on the front there of Patrick Street by St. Augustine's Church for years.
That's right. I remember as a kid, the paper man would be outside the church in Blackpool or in Black Rock, and they'd have all the papers lined up against the wall. And a lot of them were English papers that were very popular at the time, the Express and things like that. But so would you have made a couple of pound a week?
Well, I reckon I'd say we'd get about a fiver a day, you know, and it'd be fantastic, like, because every one of us that sold the papers, 90% of us, like, we all went to the new school on Cathedral Road, you know. And we'd all brothers, like, you had the Loonies, you had the Heafies, you had the Coveneys, you had the Maddens that sold all around the north side of the city, you had the O'Driscolls, you know, you had the O'Leary's, you had the Daly's, like Robert Daly and his brother Junior and his brother John, you know, there was all brothers, and there was about 30 or 40 of us there, like.
But what years were they? When were you selling?
I sold papers from 1970 to 1977, and I remember selling the papers when Elvis Presley died.
Go away. 77. So if you were making £35 a week in the 70s, that was ferocious money.
That was big money, yeah, because, like, especially the Sunday papers. I love selling the Sunday papers because you had so much of a selection. You know what I mean?
And would you hand it all up at home then?
Oh, I'd hand it all up at home, including my tips.
Everything. I'd hand them up at home. And would your mum give you any few bob back then?
Well, she'd have a big smile on her face, and we'd get a treat on a Friday.
But that was big money into the household in the 70s, wasn't it?
It was big money for my mum because of my other siblings as well, you know what I mean? And she was delighted. My mum was delighted, and she knew that we were safe because all the Echo Boys looked after each other in around the streets, like, and even in the head, rain and snow, like, the only reason why they knew me going around the city was when it was raining is that I used to have a 10-10-20 bag over my shoulders. I cut out the hands and I put the thing around my neck, and I had a 10-10-20 bag. That's the only reason why they knew me going around the city.
I don't know now if my mind is playing tricks on me, but for some reason I remember something like that, a guy wearing a fertilizer bag.
That's right, yeah, 10-10-20 bag inside in Patrick Street. And I was down in Patrick Street. I was down inside Bartles in Patrick Street as well, and that poor man was demented with the shouting and roaring. Like, he come out and he said, "Will you ever keep down the night? I can't hear my phone inside."
How long did the 10-10-20 bag last you?
Oh, it depends on the 20 bag. It depends on the rain, you know.
Did you have the same bag for 7 or 8 years, or did you get a present of a new one every year, or what?
No, I kept it on. I kept on to it as long as I could. You know, that's the fact that they knew we going around the city then with the
dentist. And there was no trouble or anything, no accidents, nobody ever set upon you for the money or nothing like that?
Never, never, ever. The people of Cork were generous, and, like, they really looked after us, you know. Being the Echo Boys, they looked after us. And, like, when I was sitting in the South Mall outside the Bank of Ireland, like, the people bought me down Easter eggs, and they used to give me loads of Christmas presents and everything. They were very, very generous on the South Mall.
you know, Facebook, because it was one of the richest areas in Cork.
Yeah, yeah. They had it to throw around. Yeah, yeah, the suits on the mall. Yeah. So you did all of that, handed it up all at home. And was your dad working? Was he a docker, or was he working in a factory?
No, my father was in the Defence Forces for 28 years. And then I actually ended up in the Defence Forces myself and four brothers. So we were all in the Defence Forces.
You were very busy, because you were a bread delivery boy as well. Who did you deliver for?
Well, I actually worked for a man who's, Lord of Mercy, now, Shawnee Hill was his name, and I used to always have a saying when I was asked, what did I do? I said, I had a crummy job, and I was loafing around. Yeah, and I used to go around the back of the van, and my legs dangling out the back of the van, and all we do was drop, knock, and run. And that was it.
Yeah, but you had to get paid at the end of the week, so you'd knock and wait.
You'd get paid at the end of the week, and you'd knock and wait, and then, you know, you'd have the usual, we pay next week or whatever, you know.
If they didn't have it. That was the way. Those are the days when everybody had the bread delivered. They also had the milk delivered. There was lots of people calling into the house. The rent man would call, the insurance man was called. There were different times.
That's right. And the gas man would call, taking the rubber pieces of lino out of the gas machine, because that's what my mum used to do. She used to cut up the lino and throw into the machine instead of the 50 pence.
People didn't have it. It wasn't as if they were dishonest. They just didn't have it.
So they didn't have it. The gas man knew to open up. What's all this? You know?
Yeah, they kind of understood as well, most of them, didn't they?
They kind of got it.
The gas company. They have enough money anyway. But how was life then for you after all of that, when you grew up and matured?
Well, when I grew up and matured, I tell you, it was fantastic, because there's one thing about us when we were selling the papers. We learned how to add, subtract and multiply. You know what I mean?
Quick.
We ended up then because we, like, at one stage, the boss would count the money, but then we were trusted to count our own money and have it up all in tens or twenties and pounds and all that on top of each other, you know?
Yeah.
And we'd be trusted in, like, with the pennies and the two pennies to get it all together, rather than that the boss man waiting for, we say, 14 of us at the counter, you know? And he'd say, right, count your money now, and I'd be watching you, you know? And that was the way it was done, like, you know?
Life got complicated, though, didn't it, eventually? I mean, you spent 20 years in the army, and then...
I was 19 and a half years in the Defence Forces, and for me, unfortunately, like, I went down the wrong road. I ended up being a gambler, recovering gambler and an alcoholic. But look, that's all changed today. My life has changed today because of, you know, it was the path I was laid on, and I suppose it was like years ago with my mum and dad. They gave us what they could and what they had, and that was it. And, like, for me, I believe that my path was put in front of me, and it was a path I was taking, and thank God today, like, you know, I'm going to all pass that, you know.
Well done. Well, because you had a lot to deal with both the drink and the gambling.
I'm
not saying one is worse than the other, but gambling can be a very vicious one. It can clean you out fairly quickly.
For me, I believe the gambling is the worst, because it's a silent disease.
And did you get treatment for them, or did you just go cold turkey?
I went into treatment in Arbor House, and it was the best thing I ever done, because previously I had two daughters in England that I hadn't seen, and I met a son of mine after 29 years as well. I met my two daughters after 17 years, and I was able to go over to their weddings and over to their mother.
Oh, that must have been very emotional. Yeah.
And apologise to them and make amends for, you know, the life that I'd given them. I never hit them, but I suppose, like, mentally, you know, they were all, like, my own wife, you know what I mean, Miriam, like that. Like, she was mentally, and my two kids were mentally destroyed because of my humours and everything that was going through my head, and I didn't care about nobody else, only myself. It was all about me, you know, when I was in the midst of my addictions, you know.
Well, you are very forthcoming there and very honest about what they went through. It must have carried an awful lot of guilt because of that.
Yes, I did. But look, as I said, thank God for the Alcoholics Anonymous program, and thank God for the Gamblers Anonymous program. Like, you know, I'm free today. You know, I only say that, but I'm free today. I got out of bed this morning and I didn't do anything. And with the strength of meetings for people that I go to every week, and I was working for Coomer Addiction Centre as well for the last 13 and a half years. And, you know, it was the best thing that I ever done. And, you know what I mean? And
do you do a bit of counselling there?
Well, I did. I was in the Limerick House. I was, it was called the Transition House in Limerick, and I used to look after six individuals there, you know, and they'd come in for a six-month rotation, like, you know, for people that didn't have any places to go, you know. And I worked there for 13 and a half years and tried to give people a life beyond addiction and let them know that there is a life beyond addiction.
And there's a life and, after rehab, isn't there?
But I, oh, there is.
Because I only mention that because, you know, yeah, sadly over the years on air, I've heard of people who have come out of rehab and they, with the best will in the world, but sadly, it happened with a very close friend of mine, in spite of numerous attempts at rehab, amongst them Cúin Mhuire, best will in the world. It just didn't work out.
Yeah, unfortunately, everybody doesn't get it, you know. And that's what we say, like, it's only in the day, you know. And, like, for me, my life changed around. Like, I went to college, you know. I left school when I was 10 and I went to college in Limerick about 5 years ago, University of Limerick, and I ended up getting the diploma. And after that, then I actually ended up publishing my own book as well.
You published the book Shadows on My Shoulder?
I did indeed, yeah. Yeah.
I wouldn't mind seeing a copy of that book, Con.
You know, it was fantastic. It was great. Like, and look, that's life.
Do you manage, in your own case, to build all bridges again? Does everybody always accept the apology and the contrition?
Yes, they do, because it's you're making amends to your peers or your people that you hurt before. And, like, what you're doing is trying to let them know. And the way I'm letting my wife and my kids know today that I'm making amends is that I'm doing my meetings, I'm doing the best that I can for them today, and, like, you know, I can't forget what they went through, and I can't forget where the addictions brought me, you know what I mean? You must never ever forget that, because I have to respect each addiction every day. I have to respect it, because I know it can crawl up on me any second time of the day or night.
I was chatting with somebody last week and they made a very valid point to me. I don't know how the conversation came about, but she said to me that she believes that everybody, as a mature grown adult at any age, it's never too late, particularly if they've been through trauma or episodes in their life that, you know, changed their path and they went on a different course, that they should write a letter to their younger self. Did you ever contemplate any of that? That if you were able to talk to you as an echo boy, and what you would possibly say?
Well, it would be very hard, you see, because I was dyslexic as well. You know, I didn't actually learn how to read or write, and I didn't actually learn how to mature until I actually ended up selling the papers around the city, going into the Defence Forces, and then going along to help other people, you know. I always said to people that to be nice to write a letter. Like, when I was in counselling, I was told to go away and write down how much money I'd spent over, we say, a lifetime that I was gambling. And of course, I was there and I put it all down, and I went into my counsellor and I handed her about 8 pages, and it was an awful lot of money that I had gambled. And she just said to me, "Con, look down on that now again," she said, "and you can multiply that by 3.
You'll never ever what?
That I never, ever, ever know exactly how much money I gambled.
I thought you weren't supposed to do that.
You weren't supposed to do?
Add up the money lost or anything. I thought that part of the treatment was not to do that. I've asked gamblers that in the past and people who are in recovery, and they say, that's one area I'm not going to go to because it's not healthy.
This was asked of me to do that, and believe it or not, I actually, when I started writing down how much I'd done or how much damage I'd done and everything else, and all I could do was try and think of the money and the people that I left down, and, you know, the rings that I sold from my fingers for my addiction, you know. That was on the last day of my addiction. I remember that I sold all my rings to cash converters inside in town, money that I stole from the home and things like that, and bills I didn't pay, and the whole lot. And, like, I was letting things get on top of me, and I wasn't letting my wife know everything about my addiction.
And by writing all of that down, is that in an effort to set you free or give you a very strong tool or to equip you with strength to say, God, that was just awful. I've got to make sure I never do that again.
It brought me back to realization as to what was happening with my life and what damage I'd done around me, you know. And I can't say that I'll never do it again. You know what I mean? There's one thing I can't say, that I'll never do it again, because I only had this for today, you know.
So you wouldn't say which was a harder cross to bear, would you? Would you say it was gambling?
Or, I would. Yeah. Personally, for me, I would, yes.
Yeah.
Personally, for me, I would, yes, because it's a silent disease. Me walking down the street and I could be all smiles, you know, waving at people and all that. And in the end of the day, I'm crying on the inside, you know, because I'm kicking myself and I'm giving out to myself and I'm swearing I'll never, ever do it again. And going home then, knowing that there will be plenty of pitch or no sound. But I knowing that there'll be plenty of pitch or no sound. And it was like the shields went down at the side of my head, like, and I just didn't give a care. But this was all about me.
Yeah, but you survived it. There are those that didn't and couldn't and hadn't the will to go on.
I did. And I survived it because of the strength that I have and the people that I've met throughout. You know, my time being in recovery, and like no matter where I went, and they always say, like, many meetings, many chances, few meetings, few chances, and no meetings and no chances.
No chances,
you know. You have to get the meetings, you know.
Yeah, I know. I think we have a bigger problem now, say, with gambling than we ever had before, with a lot younger people who are now gambling, a lot more accessible on your smartphone. And yet the profits that the companies are making are just billions and billions and billions per year.
Like, I know you were saying that about that, like, but like when I went into the into recovery first, like, I wanted to go around the city and blow up all the slot machines, you know what I mean? I wanted to go in and throw a bomb into them, but I can't, because in the end of the day, like, there's people out there, you know, people are giving out about profit making and everything else, like the pubs and all that, like, but look, it's a business, it's their business, you know what I mean? It's what they've done with their lives themselves, you know what I mean?
Oh, I know, but it's the insidious way of it being marketed and advertising and how it attracts different age groups, and it's the different bets that you can put. You can literally bet on anything now. And you're given free bets to sign up. Come on.
You are, yeah. It's on front of your phone, like, every day of the week, you know what I mean? Like, I remember now, and I just tell you this quick one. I had buried a good, very, 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 very good friend of mine, right? And on the day, we went off back to the pub with his family and the whole lot. And of course, I was worried about my car being parked up the road. And this was in Blackpool. And of course, I was going out every 4:30, checking on the car to make sure there was no traffic warning around, you know. And I went out about 4:30, and I was walking back from my car, and this man showed up behind me. Hello, he said, are you all right? I said, I'm just checking on my car there. He says to me, I don't worry about that. He says, do you know the booking office there? I said, yeah. He said, go in there. He said, and tell him, he said, that you're going to place it. He said, and they'll give you a ticket for your car.
You see?
Do you know what I mean? And that was me at my lowest, burying my best friend. And that was a challenge that was put in front of me. Do you know what I mean? And like, I just couldn't believe it. Like, a man said, I go in there. He said, and I place it there for you. He said, and I'll give you a ticket for your car.
Unbelievable.
Said, no, don't bother. Thanks. You know, thanks very much. No, don't bother.
No, you did. And listen, you didn't do it, because if you'd walked through those doors, we may not be having this conversation now.
That's right, Jeff. That's right, Jeff.
Well, listen, you know? I'm delighted. I'm delighted. Here's a typical text from this morning with regards to you. What an inspirational man Con is. Continued success to him in the future. And so say all of us, Con. And so say all of us.
Thank you. Thank you. And I just want to say thank you to Marion, and thank you to everybody in the cast. They're fantastic. It brought a tear to my eye last on the opening night. You know, I actually went to see the play, and I tell you something, man, it brought a tear to my eye.
Well, I'm really glad it did.
And the cast is fantastic, and we do want to push it to go to a bigger stage.
A bigger venue. We need, as they said in the movie Jaws, we need a bigger boat. Mind yourself, Con. Thanks for taking the call.
And one thing, Neil, is that I was listening to your show yesterday, and the echo will unfortunately go silent.
It's sad, isn't it? It's sad.
It's very,
you know? Do you ever practice your echo call from back in the day?
Oh, I did. I used to always go, echo, echo, evening echo, man shot dead, he woke up early next morning, read all about it, echo.
that's the best yet. That sounds to me as if you're selling the Sun or a tabloid or something.
You know what I mean? Well, that's to get the people in, like.
Hook them in, boy, hook them in. God, I must get more of that story. Sell me one of those there, Con. Good luck. See you.
The Neil Prendeville Show on Red.
Red FM. Conversation that matters.
And for all of the conversations we have as we head across May and into June, I've got Live of the Marquee tickets to give away for the best calls, texts and comments. We've got the Sugar Babes, the Coronas, Gavin James, Van Morrison, Bingo Loco, Bicep, John Bishop, One Day, Damien Dempsey, Neo, Brian Adams, Jenny Green and the RTE Orchestra, Mick Flannery, the biggest disco, Lyra and Tom O'Dell to give away tickets for all of the big gigs. And you can win yourself too with the best calls or best comments on this here radio program. So bear that in mind, get involved in the conversation. Regarding the Stardust and my conversation earlier on this morning with various different people, but I think in particular Patricia O'Connor, who survived the Stardust fire. Amazing listening to that woman. I wonder what our feelings are with regards to the owners. The Butterleys avoided consequences all those years. They were happy, I suppose, to accept that it was arson. Can justice be made now? Well, there's very little I can say to that except that the Gardaí, now that it's been unlawful killing, there could well be a criminal investigation. There would have to be an unlawful killing. As to whether or not the Butterleys would be part of that investigation, I'm not so sure it's fair to say that anybody was happy to accept that it was arson or happy to accept the money. Far be it from me to be defending anybody, but if that was what the tribunal said back in the early 80s, that's all they had to go on back then, although it just was not believed. It just was never believed by the people. Why didn't Simon Harris apologise to the families of the 12 hunger strikers left to die, or the families of the elderly people left to die in this so-called pandemic we went through? Okay, thank you for that, Frick. I totally agree with your caller. I remember the fire well. There was talk of political collusion even back in the 80s. We need to ask the question, who stalled all this for 43 years. Regarding state compensation for the families of the Stardust victims, for those who oppose this compensation, the families and the survivors would not be compensated for the fire, which was a private sector incident. They would be compensated, people, for everything that came afterwards, including their decades-long mistreatment at the hands of the state. Well said, Richie. Well said. You summed it up there correctly. Another texter says to me, I don't know if you saw the exchange between Helen McEntee and Michael McNamara on Monday at the Oireachtas Committee, but mother of God, I'm sure it will be shown to school kids one day as an example of how utterly incompetent people are in their jobs, the jobs they should not be in, including the Minister for Justice. They have utterly destroyed what was once a beautiful country. The current administration is a terminal cancer on our country, says Dara in Blarney. Now, I have an excerpt of that, actually. Now, I'll play it in a second, but just to give it context, there were 7,300 people who have been through the application process and the appeal process and have been refused refugee status since the start of 2023. These are people who have come here, applied and failed, appealed and failed. And the way it is now, you are not automatically deported, you self-deport. So 7,300 are told, off you go now, in your own time, get a plane ticket or get a ferry ticket and leave the country. I mean, who's going to self-deport? So of the 7,300, as in 7,300, less than 100 have been deported. Less than 100. Oh my God. I mean, what are those that are supposed to be running and looking after the people of this country and the welfare of the state and the running of the state, if you like? What exactly are they doing? Because it's just criticism after criticism after criticism. So that texter was referring to, I have some of the audio here as an excerpt from it. You're hearing, at this stage, you will be hearing Helen McEntee and Michael McNamara from Monday at committee.
Minister, you said earlier that the new take-back mechanism would be better, that it wasn't open to other countries to frustrate it. In 2023, your department issued 188 transfer decisions. That means 188 cases where another country said, yes, we're responsible for processing this person, and yes, we'll take them back. Of the 188, you transferred three. Can you explain that?
I suppose this just shows the inefficiency of the Dublin 3 system.
No, but it shows the inefficiency of your department. Another country said they'd take them back and accepted they would take them back and had responsibility. Your department is transferred to 3. Where's the problem?
No, we can only issue a take-back request. So it is then for those
But a decision, the other country accepted responsibility, accepted they would take them back. A decision was made to transfer them and you transferred 3 of those 188. Where's the problem?
Again, it's my understanding that it was not within, and again, without having seen the details of them, but if it's not within the time frame, even if there's a...
Yeah, but why did you run out of time? You've 6 months.
If the other country frustrates...
No, they didn't frustrate it. They accepted they were taking them back. So what's the problem in your department in implementing this Dublin 3 regulation?
So if you can show me that they were accepted within the six-month time frame.
Oh, they were.
If you can show that to me. So again,
you can't issue a transfer decision without another country accepting responsibility. So that was done.
That's just an excerpt of it. I mean, it's like... If it was a sitcom, you'd be laughing at it, wouldn't you? Anyway, so the 188 that had failed in their application and their appeal, out of the 7,500, 188, there was an agreement already with the countries to take them back. And of the 188 that were agreed to be taken back by countries from which they left to come to Ireland, only 3 were sent back. And it wasn't as if the other countries were putting obstacles in place. They were willing to take the 188. It's just chaos. It's beyond chaos. Back after the break.
The Neil Prendeville Show on Red FM.
Conversation that matters.
A lot of different texts on different topics this morning, and lovely responses to people listening to our lovely chats about the Echo Boys. There was also a well-known Echo Boy, James Buckley, on Blarney Street, but he passed away last year at the age of 83. Well, I wonder now, you know, how long James Buckley was selling Echoes, because some people literally went on to sell newspapers all of their lives. It could have been the Echo, it could have been the Examiner, it could have been the Star, the Mirror, the Sun. They did Sunday papers and everything. My dad would tell us to put our pocket money into a special box under the stairs. I was 15 before I found out it was the feckin' gas meter all along. talking about men and what they get up to. Hi, Neil, I work 6 days a week, every week. This is a bit of men bashing going on there the last few days. I have a super wife at home with 3 young boys. She has the dinner ready every evening. We don't think this is unfair. It wouldn't make much sense if I landed home at 6 o'clock and started making the dinner for the family, would it? Are people gone that daft? It's just normal family life. Some of these women need to get over themselves. I've no intention of coming on, so don't bother mentioning my name. My wife will know who it is without a name anyway, and so will all the other wives who all do the very same as mine. Have the dinner ready at 6 o'clock when the husband comes home from work. Text 0868104106. Pick up the phone on 0818104106. We got calls on the way. William standing by.
Text or WhatsApp Neil now. 0868104106.
The Neil Prendeville Show on Red FM.
Unbelievable, that beautiful singy-songy sound of the Echo Boys on Leaside back in the day. And amongst them was William O'Brien, and he joins me by WhatsApp. William, good morning.
Good morning, Neil. How are you?
I'm good, my man. At one stage, you were turned away because you were too young to become an Echo Boy. Is that right?
Yeah, that's a true story, Neil. My uncles would have sold the Echo in Greenmount, and they would have sold them from Johnny Keller as well in town, and... Back then, I wanted to kind of be an Echo Boy like my uncles, I suppose. So when I was six. I saw the local Echo. Yeah, I saw the local Echo man, and I walked over to him and I says, "Would I be able to get a job off you there, Nailis, you know?" And he said, "You're too young." I said, "I'd be grand doing it or whatever, you know." And he said, "How old are you?" I said, "I'm 6." He said, "Look, come back when you're 7." So between the jigs, anyway, I never forget it. And I heard, you know, people on yesterday, other Echo Boys, you know, it sticks with you. And I threw my sack in anyway that day, and I went down to him, and I was dragging him by the jumper, and I was saying, "Nailis." And he was saying, "What's wrong with you?" I said, "I'm 7 today." And he gave me some he gave me some of the Echoes anyway. He says, "Go over there to the corner," you know. But the Echo was nearly bigger than me. Nailis,
I can imagine. It was the broadsheet at the time.
It was, yeah.
Oh, you were about 3 feet tall, I'd say.
Yeah, but on top of that, Neil, the money, like, you know, it would weigh you down then as well, you know, because all the coins back then, you know, you'd have 4 pockets, like you'd have 2 in your jacket and 2 in your pants, and you'd have coins everywhere, because back then, the Echo, everyone needed the Echo, so, you know.
Why did they need it? Tell me why they needed it. Why?
I suppose, Neil, it was the connection with the community, you know.
It was the local then, news anyway to begin, right? Because there was no Google, there was just RTE, there was pretty much nothing else. There was no internet, You know, there was not everybody had television, so it was the only. And even if you did, it wouldn't be Cork News, in it.
Yeah, it was the local link, and you know, like customers back then, like you know, you could be talking my old boss, like he could have had 400 or 500 papers back then, you know, and like that's covering a large area of Barrack Street, Greenmount.
Yeah,
you know,
and just staying and with that, of course, it had the television. And what was on TV that night. People went to the pictures all of the time. They needed to know what pictures were out. People were constantly looking for work and jobs. People were advertising their... There might have been tradespeople. There might have been, you know, cleaning houses. You know, there was, you know, all the reasons that people bought the Echo. There was many of them, wasn't there?
Yeah, and even with the debt notices as well, Neil, you know, some people, you know...
Oh, I forgot about that. That's the first page that people looked at.
Yeah. And people would always, you know, if they heard someone passed... You know, world would go wrong, but if it was on the Echo, you know, unfortunately, look, people were very good when I was growing up because, look, if someone died from the area, you know, they were there, you know, might have known the person, you know, and met them that often, but if you were from the area, and I think that's in the north side as well.
That's right.
Like the Cork, you know, like people know that the Echo was the link and the truth was on it, Neil, I suppose. It's like today, everything seems to be online and you're kind of saying, is it the truth or what?
But with I know,
I could never go wrong, you know. I was selling something that had the truth in it and I felt that if people were buying so many of it, there must be some good in it and it done me good, you know.
I know, it's like when you talk about people would buy the Echo to find out who had died. There was an in-law of mine, I think it might have been my wife's father, used to say, I need to check the Echo to see who died of smoking or something like that. Something, you know what I mean? That kind of thing. But when you were about six then, you wouldn't have been able to carry all of the Echoes. Like, you wouldn't have been able to handle the weight.
Well, Neil, to be quite honest, when you got the Echoes delivered, right, they were going like hotcakes. Like customers were, you know, getting them delivered to their door, and then it was where I was standing on a pitch. Like, you know, some of the Echo boys in town were asked to say, Echo, read all about it. I was asked to do that when I was seven, and I kind of went, I'm from the area, and I thought I was an old man at the time, like, you know, holding the Echoes, and everyone knew me. But what it was everyone knew where there was someone selling the Echo. There was cars beeping, you'd be running. Like 7 years of age.
Oh, you felt as if because you were on a street corner with traffic in Greenmount, you didn't have to do the Echo, Evening Echo.
No, I was asked to do it by the boss, and I thought I was pushing people away from me because I was. It didn't sound right because I was like, I have the Echo. I'll run off to the car with you if you want it. It was easier to do. But I suppose all the Echo boys had their customers and had a knack of, you know, keeping the paper dry on a wet day so that your customer wouldn't fall out with you.
You couldn't sell a wet Echo, no.
No, you couldn't give it away because there'd be murder. You know?
Did any of the mammies worry at the time that they had a seven-year-old son, maybe daughters, I don't know that there were many girls, but certainly boys, running in and out of moving traffic every afternoon, no?
No, not about it. Like back then, Neil, the cars drove a bit slower. There weren't as many on the road. But like, I think... You know, if you were appointed to be an Echo boy, you know, your boss, who became a friend, I suppose, you know, because it was all about teamwork, they knew that you were able to do it. And that's for the girls as well that, you know, sold the Echoes.
And did you work alongside young girls who were selling Echoes?
I worked with one girl for a while. It was a short stint. And a funny kind of thing is that on the hot days, like, you know, the Echo... You'll be sweating or whatever, and the Echo would print on your hand or your legs if you put it, you know, you might stop and you look and the Echo would be on your hand. And it, you don't know, funny stuff. And we always had a few quid after work because we get tips and whatever. But, you know, it was kind of mainly the lads that I knew that I went to school with in Greenmount. They worked in town.
Okay. And did you, what decade are we talking about when you were selling the Echo then?
In the 80s.
In the 80s. So, did you make much money?
Well, I wouldn't say much money, Neil. It was going, you know, it was being made and it was going home. And, you know, I was part of the family. Like, so it's like what I saw my uncles doing with their mum and dad. You know, it's part of the family, like, you know. And as I said, my grandfather was a doctor. So the work ethic was there. It was just give me the papers and I'd sell them, you know.
It's but would you give the money to your mum?
I would hand it up at home, yeah. And to be quite honest, Neil, the people in Greymount... And Barrack Street, I nearly had a week's wages from the tips I was getting.
Did you hand up all the tips as well?
Oh, I did. I handed them up between me brothers and sisters, Neil. you know, and myself, like Neil, there was a lot of the Echo boys would meet up after work and we'd make our way in town and the farmhouse would be, you know, there'd be a load of broken cakes there. And we get pastries and we meet up with Dave Hogan now as well, who's, you know, the last man, you know, still involved. Like, and like Neil, I tell you what, boy, there was no talk of diabetes back then because
you were constantly running.
We were like any cake shop, I was keeping on to me bit of change to go in and get a cake, or I might get a tart cake under a home and you know, bring it home and have brothers and sisters, and you'd be buying all potatoes and everything in Tanora.
But your mother must have been wondering why you weren't eating your dinner though.
I know, but I was involved with playing soccer and she would burn off all the calories back then.
I know. And didn't she have outings, I don't know, was it still the way in the 80s, that, like, I was playing some audio there a minute ago from the middle of the 70s. There'd be day trips to places like Yall for all the Echo boys and girls, wasn't there?
Yeah. I tell you, Neil, the camaraderie with the Echo boys was unreal. And, like, the O'Mahony brothers would have been supplying my own boss at the time with the papers, and that was, like, family generation, you know, and I tell you, we never wanted for anything. And the late Michael O'Regan now would have been an organiser of the all trips. And I tell you, you'll be looking for pockets to bring stuff home, you know.
What would you do in Yall, though? I know there was the big beach and all that, but what was the crack down there?
We go to the old parks below there. They give us all the money in the world to go on the rides. And if you're after going on the ride 10 times, you get another few bob to go on again. Like,
wasn't that really generous of them, though? In fairness,
we look forward to that. Like, you know, and like my old friends who are from Greenmount, they sold them in town. And to be quite honest, like, I say it's the makings of a lot of people, Neil. You know, it was a great job, great for self esteem, great for, you know, your character. And as I say, it's the best job I ever had, to be quite honest.
Really? I mean, I know it would have given you a great work ethic.
Neil, there's a different connection with the community when you're an Echo man or an Echo boy. You're out there, you're in all weathers, and you're meeting every walk of life, and, you know, it teaches an awful lot. And as I said, look, you know, I will say, that's my claim to fame anyway, you know.
Yeah.
And personally, you can't lose that once you get it from a young age. It's not saying that, you know, kids today should be doing certain jobs at a young age. It's a different environment today, but what we got back then and what's on the stage today with Marion Wyatt, like, you know, that's a great investment for Cork City. Like, you know, that, you know, the Echo Boys is live on the stage, and hopefully gets all the support for, you know, being in the Cork Opera House to keep Corkness alive, Neil. That's what we need.
I hope it goes to a bigger venue, because I know many people would go, but sold out so quickly. But it's true, actually, because you would have had Echo Boys and girls selling on a daily basis of an afternoon and maybe on the weekends and everything. But there were also kids going around working for a milkman on the back of a truck, or there was others where the kids working for a bread man delivering the bread and things like that. So, and there was handy money being made in all those jobs, and much of that money was going home to supplement a meagre wage coming into the house anyway in tough times. I mean, the 80s were bad. Like, they weren't a good decade. Mass unemployment, you know?
Yeah. And there was a recession in the 80s. It's the generations, Neil. You know, our parents and grandparents done their best. You know, they worked the hard jobs. They showed us how to work. They showed us how to link in with the community, with people. And look, Neil, the days for giving someone a half a bottle of milk or passing the Echo up to them is nearly gone. You know, after you're sharing, that's kind of gone. You know, community's a little bit different. And I think with this being live now, the Echo Boys, it's just letting people know that, you know, this is Cork, you know, and we want to keep that alive, that, you know, we're kind, you know.
Yeah. And you're out again now feeling as if you're an Echo Boy locking on doors because you're running in the locals, aren't you? In the South Central Ward?
Yeah, and like that, Neil, that's the feeling getting, you know. I'm not pushing anything, you know. I'm bringing myself out there with my volunteers. We have a nice approach, and, you know, we're meeting people we didn't see for a while, but we're meeting people that are only waiting to see us because, you know, they're looking for a bit of change.
And tell me this,
do you remember the pound coins when they came out?
Yeah.
Well, there was a fellow one day, he looked wealthy to me. He was driving a Mercedes, and he'd always come along, same time every day. And when the pound coins came out, I ran over anyway. I was a bit aware of that day because you might have to do the change a bit different, you know. So between the jigs anyway, he said, I'm in a hurry. And he was trying to fly through the lights. And when he gave me the money, it felt different in my hand. And as he's walking back to the corner, I looked at it and it was four brand new pound coins.
Four? For an Echo?
He gave me £4 for the Echo, and the Echo was only 40 pence.
Right.
So I thought he would give you a 10 pence tip, Musa, right? He gave you 50 pence, and you keep the 10 pence. But he gave me £4 coins, right? And I didn't know what to do with it because I was going, he said they're giving me too much. And I know he gives me tips. But you know what? It left a lasting impression. I mean, that he must have said, I have it to give it. And like that, I think that's what life is about.
Oh, you mean it wasn't a mistake? He gave you £4 coins on purpose?
Yeah.
You would think that, I hope it was a mistake.
Well, he came back the following day and he got the Echo and he just gave me a smile, you know, like, you know, and I got tips that day off people, and people made mistakes giving me, we say, 3 tenpences and £1, which would have been 1.30
yeah.
for the Echo, which was only 4. And to be honest, Neil, they're memorable things, but, you know, today it's about the Echo Boys on the stage and it's great for Cork City.
Well done. Just one final question. If I was to ask you one thing that people are talking to you as a candidate on the doors, this is off topic, what are they talking to you about? What concerns the most?
Families, Neil. Families are suffering.
So it's cost of living then?
Yeah, and that's people, you know, people are going to work. They haven't got time for themselves. Maybe the husband's going out in the morning, the wife is going out in the evening, the kids are, you know, with grandparents. It's hard. Neil, it's after coming on top of people. Yeah,
family life. Yeah, that's a good answer.
Family life. And that encapsulates everybody, you know, people with disabilities, people that are just saying, you know, how has it gone away from us, you know, and we need to kind of bring people together, and that's in city council and above the dial, you know.
Okay, listen, that's a good answer and I can understand why people are saying that. You've put it very well. I have to ask you though, like everybody else, have you got an Echo Boy chant? Have you got an Echo Boy shout, even though you were slow enough to use it? Con Hurley gave a grand one there earlier on. Have you got one?
Well, Neil, I used to actually sing it to myself when I was big. I used to be singing it to myself because I felt that, you know, I had the best pitch ever. No, I didn't. No one needed to.
Oh, you didn't need it. You didn't need an Echo Boy show. But let's hear it.
Echo, read all about it.
Okay, I give you maybe a 6.5 out of 10 for that. Is that all right, William?
Yeah. Well, if I knew there was a prize, Neil, I would have probably given a better pitch. You know?
You'd have given it Holly. All right, good luck. Did you sell the Holly bow as well? I suppose you did, yeah?
We did, and with the Sunday papers as well. But Neil, it's great that this is live, that, you know, Cork has, you know, got his bit of aliveness back again with the Echo Boys, and I wish the whole the cast and Marion the best going forward. And they shouldn't be trying to, you know, they shouldn't be trying to get it where it needs to be. And as I said, I hope everyone keeps enjoying it.
Well, I know we've calls in. I don't know whether the calls are made yet. Thank you so much for that, William. We've put calls in to the Everyman and also to the Opera House to see are they interested. I know there's the Triskel and places like that, but you never know. It needs to be picked up in a bigger venue. Brian, good morning.
Good morning, Neil.
Is that a photograph of you standing next to your man Les from Corrie?
That is in Academy Street, yeah, where the old examiner office used to be.
All
in
right.
1997 that was taken, yeah.
Okay, so you were you an Echo Boy in the 90s then, is it?
I was. My spot used to be Grand Parade, where Foot Solutions is now, you know, that stretch of road there. I used to be out on the main road in between the cars.
Okay, did you start young or what?
I started young, yeah. I think it was probably one of my first jobs. I used to kind of hang around town a lot when I was in my teen years. And I used to do that for a while. And then I holded the sign outside the top of Academy Street for Football Crazy. That's how the picture was taken for Les Battersby, because the reporters used to come out at lunchtime and ask questions on the street and take pictures. And one time a reporter came out and he said, oh, Les is in the office if you want to go down and take a picture. So he brought me down to the office, took the picture, and a couple of days later then he came back to me with the picture in hand and gave it to me.
Ah, that was very kind of him. So your office was the corner of Patrick Street and Academy Street, which had been at the
Academy Street, but where the Modern used
the
to
Modern
be there,
was the, outside the Modern was your office. And what do you mean? You held a sandwich board for Mr. Football, is it?
It was a sign for Football Crazy. It was a sign, you know, just to kind of point people down the end of Academy Street, you know, to go that way to the store. Yeah,
Were you in school doing all of that?
No. This is kind of during the summertime. It would have been during the summertime.
All right.
So, I used to do a bit of that, and I used to do selling a bit of the Echoes then up at the other side, up in Grand Parade.
Do you make handy money?
It was handy enough back then. Yeah, I would make a few bob. I think I was, I'm not too sure, but holding the sign, I think I was probably fair about £5 an hour back then. Would have been, yeah, about £5 an hour, I think.
Fiver an hour in the 90s? Yeah,
yeah, nine to five, a full day, full shift.
A whole day holding a sandwich board, like over your shoulders, is it?
I don't know. You just, like, there used to be traffic lights there, and you could just kind of nudge the sign under the traffic lights, so it actually stayed there. You wouldn't even have to hold it. You just stand next to it.
You're making money in other ways now, are you, with a bit of recycling here and there?
Oh, God, yeah. Don't talk to me about that. No, that was... yeah, I brought the bin back there that I was speaking to there a few weeks ago.
Okay, so you actually brought it back to get your money, but how much had you gathered, say, plastic bottles and cans?
Oh, I can't remember. No,
I can remember. You had 65 bottles and 173 cans.
Yeah, I was 170. What happened was I filled it up, and when it was full, I kind of didn't really want to bring it back because it was too much. I was like, oh, that's way too much to bring it back because the bin was full. So I put it into the back of the van. Now, obviously, you wouldn't be dragging a bin around if you didn't have, you know, a van or a car to put it into.
Yeah.
But I put it into the back of the van anyway, and I forgot about it. And after turning a couple of corners and getting the littles, I opened the back of the van, and all the cans just scattered all over the back of the van. So it was about 10, 15 minutes putting it back into the bin, only to take it back out again.
Well, let me just say one other thing. I've seen the video and you look the very same now as you did in the mid 90s. You haven't aged a bit.
I haven't aged a bit. Yeah, they all say that to me. I still look the same.
Now, so you loaded one by one into the machine, the return scheme machine, one by one. Did it accept every bottle and every can?
It rejected a couple. You kind of just had to turn them a different way. You know, obviously the scans in it, you know, when it was trying to scan it, it could pop it back out. But it accepted every one of the bottles I had and accepted all of them. They had the R logo on them. So, yeah, you can go back to any shop. It doesn't, you know, I think somebody was saying to me, in the EU, it's a bit different in the EU, I think, that if you buy stuff in a shop, you have to go back to that shop.
Okay, okay. Well, you didn't. How long did it take you to insert 65 bottles and 173 cans?
Too long. About 20 minutes. I was at it about 20. By putting the cans back into it after spilling in the van and taking them back out of the bin and putting them into the machine, about a half an hour.
Are they all Coke cans?
Most of them were Coke cans and a lot of them were bottles of water, yeah.
Don't tell me that you drank 173 cans of Coke.
Well, no, it wouldn't specifically just be me. It would be my nieces and nephews as well and all that, you know. Everybody in the household that would put all their stuff into the bin. It wasn't just all mine, like.
That's what you're telling me anyway. And, okay, so how long did it take all of you to put together 173 cans of Coke and 65 plastic water bottles?
Probably about four or five weeks ago.
Thanks God for that. I thought it was just a week's supply or something. Thank God for that.
Oh God, no. You didn't go through that much in a week.
So how much did you make from the 65 plastic bottles and the 173 Coke cans?
36 euro and 10 cents.
It's handy money, isn't it?
It's handy money, but it's a complete waste of time, to be honest with you, Neil. Like, years ago, you were speaking there, you know, about people doing jobs there as bread delivery and milk deliveries. Do you remember the time when you used to put your glass bottles out for the milkman to collect them?
Yeah, I do.
You know, they'd come in a glass bottle and they had little foil caps on top of them.
Yeah.
You put them in the little crate and then the milkman would come along. Like, that's the way it should be now. Like, because glass seems to be recycled a lot more than plastic. You know, that's why they're pushing for plastic for this big thing with plastic, is because there's a lot less of it being recycled.
Ah, well, if that's the case, you should have given all the cans and bottles to a niece or a nephew. They'd have said thank you very much to 36 euro 10 cent.
Yeah, I still have the receipt. When I was finished it all, I had the receipt in my hand and I was going to go up to the cash register and get the money back. But when I went up then, so I only had to queue up then and behind a lot of people with their shopping just to get my money back. So I still have the receipt at home. I didn't even get the money back yet.
Well, fair play to anyway. You did it and you promised you would and you videoed it. I think we've shared your video of the experience of loading all those into the refund machine up on our Facebook and Twitter or X, whatever it is, and we'll reshare it again for people listening. So you're the king of pop.
That's a new one to me. I've been called many names. Like, people call me Gandhi, Wally. The King of Pop is a new one.
Why do they call you Gandhi?
Because I look like Gandhi.
You actually do look like Gandhi.
And another time then, I dressed up as Wally with the red and white shirt. And
you do look like Wally. You look like a small Gandhi. No disrespect to the man. If a picture here of your 1988 standing up against a van with a whole load of echoes and you have a big Gandhi head on you.
Yeah, there's a kind of a story behind that picture, because I know the way you'd have your customers when you were selling the Echo and that. There was a guy in the van there that time. I think it's Captain Tom O'Brien. He took a picture of me selling the Echoes on the streets, and he said to me, "Can I have your address?" So I can, yeah, back then, though, you know, you had the films and the cameras and that. He goes, "Can I have your address there? And I'll post that picture to you in a couple of weeks." I goes, "Yeah, no problem. You could do that." I didn't hear anything about it for a few weeks, you know, and then it actually came through the letterbox. He had posted that, so I was kind of looking up his name there last night when I found the picture to see, you know, if he had a business or something in Calgary Lane. And I think I found a kind of RIP. I think I saw him up on RIP that he actually passed away there a couple of years ago.
He was Captain Tom O'Brien.
From Calgary Lane, Captain Tom O'Brien from Calgary Lane. I think it's the same person. It probably is, yeah. But I think he passed away there2013.
Fair play. You still have a photo. You have the photograph that was taken in 1998. I couldn't find something that I put away last week. Never mind in 1998. Go on, give us your big echo shout there, King of Pop.
Echo, evening echo.
Come on, you can do better than that. Not fairness.
I don't want to blow the ears off, Neil.
Go on, lay it on me, man.
Echo, evening echo.
All right, nice one. Stay in touch, Brian. Mind yourself. All the best. Good luck.
The Neil Prendeville Show on Red FM.
Conversation that matters.
Actually, to be fair, Helen is right. I did see the video. There's this character who has one bottle, right? And he ties a string around the neck of the bottle and he pushes it in and he pulls it out and it registers. It's on the string. He pushes it in, pulls it out with the string and it registers. And he must be absolutely rolling in the dark because he sees the same bottle over and over and over again, pulling it out with the string and it keeps rocking up. Bottle 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 until somebody comes along and takes him away or arrests him or says, hey, you can't be doing that. But the way people come up with making money or turning any situation to their advantage never ceases to amaze me. I don't usually look for help. I'm usually trying to help people on the air, but I just have a question for people. I need to get a key cut fairly rapidly around about 1 o'clock today. Fastest place for me to do it is Douglas. But can somebody tell me, is the cobbler in Douglas Court still doing business there and are they still cutting keys and fixing and shoes and all that kind of thing? Text 0868 104 106. I'm not 100% sure, so rather than a wasted journey, are they cutting keys in Douglas Court? Text 0868 104 106. But to more serious matters, to call this heartless is an understatement. To steal somebody's motorbike, of course, is bad in the middle of the night, but to steal a motorbike that's used by people who are part of the Blood Bike South charity, which are people on bikes that move blood very, very quickly when needed in emergency and other things like that. I think they might do also medicines and pharmaceutical products they need to get from A to B quickly. Well, that is particularly cruel, but that's what's happened to Alphonse, and he joins me by phone. His bike was robbed in the middle of the night. It's a pretty horrific thing to do to somebody. Alphonse, good morning.
Neil, good morning. How are you?
I'm well. I think you, and this is in the Knockraha area. Have you captured, or did a neighbour capture something on CCTV?
Yeah, so all my neighbours actually came together, and I've gotten footage of these two guys, multiple sources of them trying to break into cars and all that, and I also have them on my camera actually taking the bike away at 2 o'clock in the morning, yeah.
That's tough video to watch, I'd say. So they're going from driveway to driveway, checking car doors, is it?
Correct. Yeah.
Okay. Do you see these two approaching your bike then as well in the video?
Not clear, because my bike at the time was parked behind my back wall of my house. So I can only just see it just over the wall. So we don't have a clear picture of that, but neighbors have a lot clearer picture, yeah.
Okay. When did this happen? Something like 2 in the morning? Was it over the last few days?
Yeah, it was on Tuesday morning at 2 o'clock in the morning.
How did they start it, do you think? How did they get it away? You don't know?
I would say they probably broke the steering lock with their foot, and they probably hotwired it in some direction, in some way. And because we can definitely, we can see the lights coming on in the bike and all that, so they definitely got past the ignition part.
And did the two of them jump up on it then and go?
I would say so. That's just out of my camera view, but I would imagine so, yes.
What do you use the bike for, Alfonso?
So that's my my bike that I use for going in and out of town, and also for going in and out of work. So you can imagine with blood bikes, we do shifts from 7 o'clock in the evening till 7 o'clock in the morning. So if I'm on shift and I get an urgent call in at like 7 o'clock, I have to make it into our base very quickly to try and get the bike and do the run, obviously. So this bike allows us to go, you know, it allows me to go through traffic and filter in between traffic and get into the city quickly, you know.
What are you transporting when you're on shift?
We'd be transporting blood samples from, you know, CUH labs down to maybe the Mercy or into the South Infirmary or to the blood bank. We do out-of-town shifts as well where we're running bloods as well and samples up towards Dublin. Or we're taking donated breast milk up the north as well to be processed. You know, basically anything that can really fit in the motorbike, you know, that's urgent, that's out of office hours that they want to transport to the hospital, you know.
This is heartless. It really is absolutely heartless. Would they have known of what they were robbing?
I'm not 100%.
Doesn't make it right, I know, but I'm just trying to compare. Right. Like, is there signage? I mean, like, it's like somebody robbing or torching an ambulance. It's a very important vehicle.
Yeah, I have other vehicles that were parked beside it, which had blood bike stickers all over it. So I think it would have been fairly obvious to anybody that that this was obviously a bike that we use for this kind of stuff. As I said, I have no words to describe these people, right? I don't think it's allowed on air. So
I can understand your anger. I really can, and frustrate. You can't work then, no?
Well, I don't know. I have another vehicle I can take into work. But, you know, as I said, for emergencies, when we have to get into the city quickly, you know, between 6 and 7, you can imagine, you know, the queues there sometimes up by the Silver Springs and all that. Going in, you know, if I was in a car, that could take you an hour.
No, the bike is, no, it's very important, A to B, quickly. It's blood. I mean, it's a perishable product. I understand that. So, like, the guards know about it? I don't know what the recovery rate is for motorbikes. Do you know?
I'm not 100% either, to be fair. But, like, in fairness, I've gotten a lot of help from people. I've gotten a lot of hints. I think the bike has been spotted now 3 times up on the north side of the city, around where Apple is, around that direction. So we think that the bike is going to probably be dumped somewhere up there. So, you know, I would ask, you know, the public, you know, I would appeal to the public, anybody up there, you know, if they see it, to contact me or the Garda directly. But if they're uncomfortable doing that, I'm definitely open to receive any messages.
Okay, my friend. Okay, it's a red 1996 Honda Trans Am. It's a beautiful looking bike. The reg is 96D60393. It's a 96 red Honda Trans Am, 96D60393. If anybody spots it, they can either get in touch with us, text 0868104106 or the Gardaí. And hopefully, fingers crossed, you'll get it back in one piece.
Definitely. You know, it's as I said, the value of the bike isn't that large because it's obviously a reasonably older bike. But the value that I get from that bike...
A bike saves lives. That makes sick people healthy and saves lives, that bike and you riding it. And we commend you for that. It's an horrific thing to do. And it's not too late for somebody to get a pang of conscience and just abandon it somewhere it can be seen and returned to you. Let's hope for the best, Alfonso.
I suppose, Neil, you know, we're appealing to these guys. I don't think it's really going to do much for us because, look, at the end of the day, you know, the area where these guys look, they work at night. They don't get up before 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon, right?
No, listen, so I know. I mean,
everyone's listening, but, you know.
The chances...
I'm just appealing to anybody else, you know.
No, to keep an eye out for it. Okay, absolutely. Get on to the Gardaí. Alphonse, let's hope there's good news. Do stay in touch if there's an update, all right?
Will do indeed.
Take care for now. It's a particularly horrific thing for somebody to do to another human being. Anyway, Make-A-Wish National Collection Day is tomorrow, lads. Be generous if you can. It makes a huge difference in people's lives. Make-A-Wish, their National Collection Day. Our lines will stay open. Thank you. There's about a dozen or so texts saying yes. The cobblers are still in Douglas Court cutting keys. Thank you so much. You dug me out of a hole there. You opened a door or two for me. Have a good day. I'll see you tomorrow.
The Neil Prendeville Show on Red FM.
Conversation that matters.